One podcast has crushed the horror landscape, leaving behind the silent audio waves of all of those who have came before. Introducing our hosts. This man needs no introduction, but needs 7 takes to record his own. He is known for rating bad movies high and known for rating good movies high. Don't try to call him because he only phones it in. He is our host from the foreign land of Canada, Mood 616. This man is willing to die even on the smallest of hills. He argues to the point in which he disagrees with himself. A man who knows a remake when he sees one. He is the Mexican-born super producer known as the humble one and the sexy one, JP. They are known for creating superstars out of their guests. They are known for being the number one horror podcast on the Horrorphilia Network, except for when they allow others to take a turn. They are the devil's advocate of horror podcasting. They are the 22 shots of moods and horror.
Yes, yes, y'all, it's going down right now. Episode 83 of the 22 Shots of Moods and Horror podcast is coming at you live. I am your host, Henry 616, also known as Moods. And of course, I've always got my partner in crime by my side, Otis.
Oh, hell no.
Also known as Double Shot G, a.k.a. Gary, also known as Double Shot J, a.k.a. JP, or my little brother Justin from PA. What's going on, my brother?
First of all, there's no way in hell I'm being Otis, okay? Like, you can't just go and say, like, oh, I get to be Henry, the cool one, the one that the movie's about, and you're my closet homosexual Otis.
Yeah, I know, right? Or the guy that tries
like,
to fuck
his
sister.
I would rather be the sister.
Yeah, Otis is an interesting character, isn't he, man? He's confused. He's very, very confused. He doesn't know if he's homosexual or if he wants to fuck his sister.
Or both.
Or both, yeah. I mean.
So if you haven't noticed by now, tonight it is episode 83 titled Serial Killers. Henry.
Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yeah. 1 and 2. It's weird that they made 2, but we'll get to that later. One of the things that is pretty cool about the new way we're doing these episodes, you know, we did it twice. I believe, was it twice last time, or did we do it only once with anthologies? Well, we did anthologies, and then we did the trilogies. I know what you did last summer, but this time it's serial killers, and it just so happens that both of the films are Henry Lee Lucas. So that's what this episode will be. We plan to probably come back to this because there's like millions of serial killer films.
Oh man, there's so many good ones. I actually just recently picked up Citizen X, which I'm really stoked to check
out. Who's that on?
It's like I can't remember exactly the guy's name. He's really, really notorious for killing like a shitload of people. You probably recognize his name slips my mind right now. It's not one of those household names, but you know, the thing about these Henry films that surprises me is that the second one is actually, you know, subtitled Portrait of a Serial Killer again.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of even so. It just I don't know. It just kind of throws you off when you see that. But yeah, there's so many. I think we could probably do 10 volumes of serial killers. I mean, there's a lot of actual really good films, isn't there? I mean, well, we were talking about like the Dahmer ones are all pretty good.
And I mean, you Bundy. Know, personally that, and the listeners that Dahmer, I was really high on. I believe it was my number 4 of 2002. Like I loved it.
Yeah. 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 It's surprising how many Dahmer films they've made that are pretty good and stuff. But yeah, there's tons, man. I still got to check out that Gacy one from that, you know, that kind of 4 block that they put out there in 2002, 2003. But the Ed Gein one is really good. Really good, man. Steve Railsback plays Ed Gein in that one.
Yeah, and just... Also, I mean, you could do like a nice little double feature for Ed Gein with Deranged and Ed Gein.
Oh, yeah. Big time. This, you know, you could even throw TCM there, but which would never happen because
that would be on a different show.
We got to get to that franchise sometime too.
I know. Zach
the question all the time. People are like, when are you guys going to start doing some popular franchises? But no, man, we really like to do the Howlings and, you know, the Leprechauns,
Children of the Corn
and like absolutely pulverize ourselves with the Howling. Even after we did that show, I think both of us were like, hey man, we should probably not do a franchise show for about 20 episodes.
I know. I really did feel like that. And you know me, dude, I never feel like that. I'm always like, when are we going to do another franchise show when we get to the franchise show. And that one, I was just like, I'm done. I'm tapping out for a little while.
It's miserable, man. I remember the conversation after, like, no way. There's no way the Howling franchise is worse than Children of the Corn. I'm like, you obviously have not seen all the films then.
And if you watch them all in a close vicinity, dude, it is like, it's just so rough. Like, I thought to me, it used to be the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise was the most painful to get through. Howling blows that away by a long shot. I would love to watch – I'd rather watch Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2 six times in a row than watch freaking six Howling films.
I would rather watch Part 3 and 4 of the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise than I don't know, man, half those Howling films. Part 7 is quite literally one of the worst films I've ever seen in my life.
I didn't hate Part 7 as much as you guys, but it's a bad movie, 100%.
It's so bad.
I think that we did say that the next franchise we're going to do is going to be a little bit of a better one, which I think we said we was going to do The Omen a few months back.
It was kind of funny because we'd originally planned to do Invasion of the Body Snatchers, all those films, and we just – I don't know. I think we should do The Omen next. Let us know your guys' thoughts, maybe The Omen, because we need JP to watch these films.
Yeah, I've still never seen any of The Omens. Yeah. And as far as TCM goes, like, that's obviously – I will not retire from this show until we at least do that. So, you know, we have to stay as long as we do that, man, because I think Zach won't be able to die. Like, he won't even be able to die in life if we don't get to TCM. He'll be like 152, just like sitting there, like refreshing the interwebs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we still have like three of the biggest franchises to do. So, I mean, they're all eventually going to come.
One that we've touched that we've actually done is Halloween, like out of the big four.
Yeah.
And like we've still not done Hellraiser. The classic Pumpkinhead franchise, we still haven't got to that yet.
The classic Pumpkinhead franchise. Oh Jesus. Yeah, I mean, they're eventually gonna come.
Paranormal Saw Activity,
yeah, and which Paranormal actually was even I think we had it on a list to do, and we just, I don't know, I think we're
Dude,
waiting
it's
for
been on the one. List since episode like 5.
Yeah, I know. I think it's because we're waiting for one to come out and then another one came out. They just keep announcing these films.
Well, that's what happened with Wrong Turn. I remember there was four – I think there was four Wrong Turns, or there might have – the fifth one might have just came out when – no, because what happened was I suggested Wrong Turn 1 through 4 back on Burial Grounds when we did that show.
That's right.
And then we carried over some of those show ideas to the 22 Shots of Moods and Horror, and then we waited because like Part 5 was out, and then – you know, it took a little while, and then they announced Part 6, and then, you know, now they announce like Part 7, so we might as well wait till that one comes out.
I know, and that's kind of the same deal with Hellraiser too, right? Since there is another one probably coming out soon.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm actually looking forward to doing that one. I think that one will be fun.
I think it is going to be fun to talk about some of the sequels, because it's always associated with being one of the worst overall franchises. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting because, you know, that's what people always said about Children of the Corn. Children of the Corn doesn't have great sequels, but they're not like the worst films in the world, maybe besides Part 6. But,
yeah.
You know, but they're not like the most dreadful things in the world. Definitely better than Part 7 of The Howling. Jesus Christ. But woo, yeah. So what's been going on, man? What'd you get up to this week?
Well, this week was actually a little more eventful than most of my weeks. I actually went to the drive-in. Second time this year I've went to a drive-in.
Nice.
Didn't go to like a retro-themed one this time, but I do plan to in September to the April or the September Ghouls Day or whatever the hell it is out in Vandergrift, PA. We went there for April, which was really cool. But I just went to like modern films this past weekend, and I went and seen The Shallows and The Conjuring 2 at the drive-in. And
crazy.
So a few bad things happened. One, I forgot all of my money at home. So like,
and then the second bad thing was, you know, just before The Conjuring 2 was ready to start, the usher came in and told you they're having technical difficulties and then they couldn't play it.
No, but funny thing is, the coworker of mine went to that same drive-in to see the same two movies, and they had to send everybody home with a refund because the audio was out of sync or wasn't coming in or something. What? Which is just brutal because apparently they were like packed, which they were packed Friday when I went too. And that this is a drive-in, guys, that I've been going to since I was, you know, literally able to pay attention to things. I haven't been in a long time. I seen Freddy vs. Jason there in 2003 on opening night. I seen a lot of movies there growing up. Haven't been there in years, probably like 7 or more. I don't even remember. I think the last thing that I seen there was like a Anchorman movie or something, or like Anchorman. Knocked Up or something. I can't remember. Yeah, it was not a horror movie. The last
thing. So you mean to tell me that The Conjuring 2 is so damn scary that it's not even allowing itself to be played in random theaters and drive-ins around North America? You know, it's just like, no, yeah. This shit's so scary. It's going to scare the shit out of these people. We're just going to throw the audio off so they can all get refunds and stuff. What the fuck is going on with this movie, man? It's crazy.
So this drive-in, though, it is a drive-in that's been around for a long time. It has a lot of history. It used to play like Bryan House films back in the day, and it did a lot of porn, like back, I think, in the 70s. They played a lot of porn. It's a 3-screen drive-in, so there's 6 movies usually every night, two on each screen. And this one was The Shallows and The Conjuring 2. And I forgot all my money except for I had $10 to pay to get in. They don't take like debit cards or credit cards. So like I couldn't buy any food. Luckily, the person that I went with hooked me up and bought me some cheese fries because I got to get some cheese fries. Yeah. And, you know, so this drive-in almost got shut down a few years ago when all the movie studios no longer was providing film. Everybody had to upgrade to digital, and I believe that Dodge or some car company or something had a big contest with all the drive-ins to you know, donate projectors to them. And I believe we was part of that contest and almost won or got close to winning or something like that. But they ended up giving us a projector anyway, I believe. And even though we lost, and then they ended up getting, you know, 2 more over the last 2 years. I believe this is the first year the third screen's been opened back up. I could be wrong on that, though. Anyway, it's amazing because these projectors are like $100,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, so I was so happy to finally be back at the drive-in. And unfortunately, one issue that I did have was we kind of parked at an odd angle or something, because during The Conjuring 2, during like the dark scenes, which it's The Conjuring 2, there's a lot of them. The screen was like black. It was so hard to see what was going on. That's the one negative about drive-ins is, you know, if you don't get that good parking spot, you're kind of effed. But
yeah, I agree.
I did like both movies, honestly. Like The Shallows, you'll like a lot. It's like definite, it's like sharksploitation style shit. You know, it's a little more of a, you know, mainstream type movie, but it's a shark movie at its core. And, you know, it's not the next Jaws or anything like that by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a fun little like popcorn shark movie. I think it's also PG-13, which I didn't know until after I seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that should have been a little bit better, because if they would have played it like straight survival horror like I was expecting, it probably would have been a little bit better. But there's a lot of like action-y type Hollywood moments where it's like, you know, kind of ridiculous and unbelievable. But a little too much CGI as well, but it was pretty solid. I definitely enjoyed that one. I'd probably give that one around a 7 out of 10. And The Conjuring 2, from what I was seeing, I was really into it. I liked it about as much as the first one, but I wouldn't even be confident in giving it a full blown rating, even though I'm going to. I'd give it an 8 out of 10 right now without seeing it again, because it was so dark that I literally missed scares. It would be like a scare, and then I'm like, "Hey, what happened? I couldn't see." You know, and the girl that I went with was also just sort of like, "I can't see anything that's going on." But she was pretty freaked out too at moments, because the music was good, and it was like, because you couldn't see stuff, you were kind of like, when you thought you seen something, it would scare you, and then it's like, "Oh wait, that's nothing. That's just dark."
So now you're just reacting to other people reacting.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, really? Something happened?
Yeah, but I mean, it was fun. I had a good time. I'm definitely going to, if they play like The Purge out there, I'll probably go back and check that out as well. See The Purge 3 and any other horror movies that come out while it's open, man. I'm down. Drive-ins are fun. In the past like year, dude, I've seen so many movies. I've went to the cinema more than I've been in years. Like I've seen 10 Cloverfield Lane and The Witch, and I've seen all those old, you know, Lost Boys and Monster Squad. And now, you know, these two movies.
Jesus,
two
now other- you're just bragging.
yeah, it's crazy, dude. And I never do that. I heard that you went to see The Conjuring, and did you end up going to see it?
Fuck The Conjuring, man. And The Conjuring 2, and fucking, no. I have shit experiences in the theater, I swear to God. But, you know, and, you know, the most frustrating thing about The Conjuring 2 episode, where obviously we didn't get to see it, was the simple fact that we don't really get a lot of horror films here. So I was like, yeah, I was all stoked to see it. And I was like, no, really? You know, like we just, like, we don't even have The Shallows. We don't have anything, man. It's just, it's terrible. So that was my big shot, man. That was my big shot to see a film on the big screen. And no, you know, instead I just end up going to see shitty films like Annabelle and, you know, garbage like that. Fuck. Not cool, right?
Yeah. So what, it's just, was you into anything this week?
What was I up to this week? Just busy, man. With the kids last week of school, he was done on Wednesday, so I've been busy. Like super busy today, actually. Yeah, I was just kind of lounging in my pool all day. That's how busy I was. No, but I've got him all day now. So it's summer holidays and stuff. But no, we were finished up with like BMX and baseball and just everything, man. It's just like go, go, go. And I'm doing this. This is all I've done all week, was just basically prepare for the 96 show and watch the films for this one. That's all I've done. I've been so busy. I haven't even had chance to, like, you know, watch other films to review. And like, it's just been a tight, tight week. So yeah. And plus we're preparing to, we have a family reunion next week, and Aaron's family all came in from Toronto. And so we're hanging out with her sister tomorrow and her brother on Saturday. So we're kind of preparing for that and shit too. So, you know, the whole family thing, I'm just like, you know, I'm not overly excited because it's exhausting, because when the whole family gets together on her side, there's like 11 kids under the age
of
11.
That's like, man.
Under the age of 11. And it's like, it's just, it's exhausting watching these kids run around. So, but, yeah, I mean, that's pretty much all I've done this week. Nothing too, too exciting at all.
I'm actually like more busy than I've been in a long time. Like today I went, one of my, homies at work, Joe is, moving on to another job, and we threw him like a little surprise party thing today. So I had to rush back home and pop in, Henry 2. I had to finish those two films. So I watched the second one. Obviously UFC 200 is next freaking weekend. Like, I'm so psyched. Me and my boy are gonna have like a big thing. I got a friend who's getting married coming up. I've never even been to a wedding, so that's kind of interesting for me.
Wow. And,
you know, also there's, I might go to a local MMA show, which I've never been to an MMA show. So, you know, it's what the hell is it? King of the Cage, which I believe John Jones came through King of the Cage. A bunch of people came through King of the Cage. I'm not even going to list them all. They have like 400 events or something so far. They've been around since like the late 90s or something.
Yeah, I've been to actually quite a few here in my hometown, because Bill Mahood is from Prince George. He fought in the UFC. So they used to, I'm assuming that he was one of the promoters that used to bring him in here. Because we went to quite a few of those King of the Cages.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. They travel all around. This is actually the second one they've had here this year, and there's a third one planned. So I think they're spending a little time in the Pittsburgh area.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, so I'm pretty excited to be still doing, to be back so soon doing the show. Like, I bet you the listeners did not expect this.
No, I think a lot of them didn't even realize the show was up. I was noticing people today going, oh, you guys are back. Like, well, it's been up for 4 days. So, but thanks for noticing. Yeah, man, completely. I was a little surprised too that you were like, yeah, you free next week? I'm like, yeah, man. Thursdays are good.
Yeah, just trying to trek through these 96 films. I figured this episode would be perfect for that. You know, kill two birds with one stone.
Exactly. Yeah. Alrighty. Should we get into some news?
Yeah, let's do the damn thing. So news this week, nothing too eventful, but there is a little bit of stuff. Annabelle 2 has now started filming. has a May 19th, 2017 release date. I know you're super psyched about that. Moods filming in Los Angeles.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's happening. That's part of the news. Let's move on.
Annabelle 2. My God. I mean, you know, I'm even surprised that, like, you know, it's not already out.
Yeah, because it made so much money, which is shocking.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm surprised after the first weekend they were like, hey, let's sign up for part two and we'll have it out in, you know, 6 months. And no, it's crazy.
The Conjuring really is, since we're not going to talk about the Annabelle news, we could at least, I guess I could at least add this to the conversation. The Conjuring really is becoming a juggernaut of a horror franchise, because first of all, the first Conjuring did great. The second Conjuring, from what I heard, was doing pretty good. I haven't checked the numbers in a while. Then you had Annabelle, which made $257 million worldwide. And now they're announced Annabelle 2. I don't think they've announced The Conjuring 3 yet, but I'm sure it's not far behind. And they kind of announced this spinoff movie called The Nun, which honestly, I'm gonna be honest, like that part in the movie, like the nun stuff, like, was really, really creepy. So that actually could be really neat if they do that. And that franchise, it's kind of an odd one right now, because would you consider Annabelle part of the Conjuring franchise at this point?
I mean, I guess if you consider spinoffs to be part of a franchise, yeah, I mean,
can
I guess
it's related. Can you think of another example of a spinoff? Movie.
Wow, there's got to be one out there. There's got to be something. Wow, put me on the spot. Something on the
well,
same.
How about
lines.
We put the listeners on the spot, guys? If you can think of a film series that's spun off into another film series, preferably horror, then let us know. But yeah, so do you consider it though, like part of the franchise, or is it not?
I don't know. It's a tough question, man. Like I said, I mean, it's related to it, but is it officially part of it? I mean,
I guess zombie, right? Zombie is the one. You got Romero's Dead series, and then you got Zombie, which is sort of a spinoff series almost.
Yeah, it pretty much actually is. I mean, it's like, it's that unofficial sequel to Zombie kind of thing.
Yeah, but
so...
Return of Living Dead is kind of a spinoff too.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's weird. It's weird.
Just about to say that.
It doesn't happen often. But I'm looking here on the Wikipedia page, Moods, and you got The Conjuring 2013, The Conjuring 2 2016. James Wan has said that there could be many more Conjuring films because the Warrens have so many stories, which honestly is part of it, because it's based on like these real stories, kind of. The Warren people in real life had all these hauntings, so you got endless stories there, which really makes it interesting. So, and then also on the Wikipedia page, spinoff films, Annabelle, Annabelle 2, and The Nun. So yeah, I mean, it has them all listed down in the box office gross. I mean, this is turning out to be a juggernaut of, it's almost like what Marvel does with their superhero films, where it's like these shared universe things. I think that might be the future of sequels, kind of, where they're more spinoffs or they're in the same world. I don't know. What do you think about that? Is this the new thing? We're seeing it unfold right now and we're not even aware of it yet. Is this happening before our eyes? Is this the future?
I mean, I guess it's kind of, I mean, would you consider like Freddy versus Jason to be kind of that spinoff?
And Alien versus Predator, kind of. But
Alien versus Predator. I mean, that's kind of... It's more mashing up things.
It's more connecting two universes instead of spinning off into a separate universe. It's an interesting thought, but if you get a sequel to Annabelle and then this nun comes out and it does really well and you get a sequel to that and you get a third Conjuring film, and within that third Conjuring film they have something that is like with a clown, and then the clown gets a movie, like,
and then it just eventually comes full circle.
Yeah,
and then they just kind of meet up
huge
in like the ninth film,
and then they connect it with the Insidious franchise, since Juan did the Insidious franchise too, and then they connect it to the Fast and the Furious franchise, since Juan did that too.
Jesus. Yeah. But I mean, I could see this really happening though. I mean, as long as the films are successful, especially within that you know, that franchise, quote unquote, kind of thing, right? Why not? I mean, I guess we could consider them to be part of it. I mean, yeah. What are your thoughts? I mean, do you actually consider the Annabelle films to be part of the Conjuring franchise?
I haven't seen I haven't seen the Annabelle films, but if the Conjuring franchise, I kind of do because it's a shared continuity. Like it exists within one story, kind of, right? The story of the Warrens and the stories around the Warrens.
Yeah. So I mean, if you look at it like that, for sure.
If
yeah.
all three of these films were called The Warren or The Warrens, and then it subtitled Annabelle, subtitled The Conjuring, subtitled The Conjuring 2, I mean, it would be if one franchise. It's just based on name now that it's not, I guess. Uh-huh. And do you consider films that are clearly like not even sequel? If you consider films that are not even sequels franchise films simply because they have the same name, like Return of the Living Dead 4 and 5, for example, they have the same name and they're considered in the franchise based on that same name, even though they have nothing to do with the originals really, other than it's zombies. And there's other cases of that.
But we see that all the time in film. I mean, really, there's a lot of franchises that just kind of have. I mean, look at the Amityville franchise. I mean, it all kind of relates to that, but I mean, the stories are always so different, though, right? Yeah, I mean, look at even Amityville 8. I mean, it's just, you know, they got this haunted.
Well, Children of the Corn is another one, right? It's almost in name only at a certain point in those films. But isn't there a case to be argued that these films are actually more of sequels, or they're more connected than those films, so shouldn't it technically be a franchise almost? Because like it's arguable that these films have more in common with each other than, say, like the last four Children of the Corn films.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all sequels. So does the meaning of a sequel in name only, or is it, does it also expand to actual what's going on?
Well, it's really hard to get away from the in name only too thing. I mean, we see this so often. We see it so often within franchises, but we just automatically associate that with a franchise. I don't really think people try to think too hard about it or look too deep into the mythology of what exactly the story is that you're, you know, relating the name of the film to the franchise with, if that makes any sense. But you know what I'm saying? But I think it does, though.
I think it's a franchise. I think at this point it's the Conjuring franchise, or it's, you know, whatever you want to call it. It could be the Warrens franchise or the James Wan franchise, even though he didn't do all of them. He produced a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, dude, when you're talking between the three films that came out, a $66.5 million budget combined of the three films, The Conjuring, Annabelle, and The Conjuring 2, and it made $821 million worldwide. Yeah, that's a juggernaut crazy. Right there, man. That is a juggernaut. The Conjuring 2 is up to $90 million in North America right now, which has passed Annabelle, which was at $84 million in North America. It killed it. Annabelle killed it in other territories, though. Annabelle did great in other territories. Conjuring doing not as well as Annabelle did in other territories, but it beat it in North America. So pretty damn interesting. And so far, you have The Conjuring with an 86% review on Rotten Tomatoes and a 79% for The Conjuring 2. Those are both pretty high. Annabelle had a 29% review rating, which is awful, but you know, it's
25 29 20 wow, it was actually that high. That's crazy. Wow.
But yeah, so this franchise is doing big things right now.
But that movie made a shitload of money for having such a low rating. Like I mean that doesn't really surprise me, some of those films, but wow.
Yeah. Interesting enough, Annabelle had a much smaller budget than The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2. The first Conjuring had a $20 million budget, the second Conjuring had a $40 million budget, and Annabelle had a $6.5 million budget.
Really?
Yeah. So you're making $84 million in North America off of a $6.5 million budget?
Well, of course. I mean, yeah. I honestly think, though, just, you know, they made a lot of money and stuff, but the final product and word of mouth is really what I think they got to worry about here. I mean, to be honest, I'm not overly too curious with it just after seeing the first one.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I'll tell you though, Moods, every single person that I've come in contact with who's not a horror film loves Annabelle. every single person.
I think that is, you know, what we call, that's a horror film for non-horror fans.
Yeah, definitely.
So, unfortunately, I mean, I really wanted to like it, man, especially because I went
and defended it so hard.
I know.
Of course we wanted to like it.
It was funny, too, because I had a good argument with my wife about that film, too, because, you know, we're in the car driving home, and I was just telling her everything I didn't like. But I told her some things I liked.
Did she like it? She
loved it.
Exactly. It's a non-horror fan's horror film.
Yeah, exactly, right? She tries to watch films with me, but half the time she just... She's got like the attention span of a goldfish. So you know, it's like you always got to be working or doing something. But yeah, I know exactly, you know, where you're coming from with the non-horror fan thing. It just appeals, man, because it's just so there. It's just so easy to get, you know. I don't know what it is about those films, man.
Yeah.
I
guess that it comes down to Annabelle 2 slated for May 19th of 2017. Surprised they didn't go in October with that one, based on the previous one did so well in October. But The Conjuring, Annabelle, The Forthcoming Nun, 22 Shots says it's a franchise. So it's a franchise. Let's move on. We have George motherfucking A. Romero, the godfather of zombies as we know them, is being awarded a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The 76-year-old director in George Romero is getting his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's brought us stuff like Night of the Living Dead, Day of the Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and let's not talk about other dead films besides maybe Land. But he also did like The Crazies and
Creepshow.
Martin, Creepshow. A lot of stuff. He did a lot of work in TV.
I like Bruiser, man. Bruiser is always one of those films that everyone, like, no one ever seems to mention when they talk about Romero, but, you know, I like Bruiser, man. Dark Half.
I haven't seen it, so that's why I never mention it.
Yeah, I mean,
still think we need to do our Romero director spotlight one day with his non-dead films and his dead films.
I know. Didn't we have one planned? It was like, it wasn't the crazies, though. It was like, I think Bruiser was one of them.
Bruiser,
Martin.
I think Monkey Shines, Martin, or The Crazies, Bruiser. I can't remember. It was like two. It was like The Crazies, Martin, and another 70s one. Maybe it was Monkey Shines. And then Bruiser, and then some of his newer films. I can't remember.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't The Crazies, because I think we were going to do like an OG versus remake on The Crazies one time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is what was planned. But I think a Romero non-dead thing would be fun to do, actually. Then we could talk about Bruiser. We could let everyone know how cool it is.
Okay. We'll get to that one day. So, yeah, that's really, really cool that Mr. Romero is getting his star. I don't know much about the Walk of Fame. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of horror contributors who have it, but I don't see very many more fitting than the guy who created the motherfucking zombie.
That's right.
The modern zombie. But let's face it, it's the zombie. That's the one we know and love. Not many people care about the old.
Well, let's just put it this way: it's the cooler zombie. It's not the voodoo hypnotized person zombie. It's the flesh eating, gnarly, don't give a fuck reaction.
George Romero created the goddamn Walking Dead, essentially.
He really did.
Secondhandness. George Romero for The Walking Dead, damn it, now. So after that, we have a little film. And the only reason I picked this up is because I just thought it sounded cool. But apparently there's a film called The Ice Cream Truck that's completed filming. It is a campy horror film. But I figured, you know, I like the original campy ice cream killer movie, which is The Ice Cream Man, Clint Howard at his finest.
Yeah,
the classic Ice Cream Man. I loved the Ice Cream Man growing up. It actually scared me when I first seen it back in the early 90s, mid 90s on Monster Vision. And you know, watching it now, when he pulls out like a giant ice cream cone and puts a head on it, it's impossible to be scared by it. But that movie is weird, and I've always been a fan of that movie. It's really, really
me too, man.
It's one of the highlights of the mid 90s, even though it's like not serious at all. It's so damn just fun.
It's like so strange. The other night, I think it was Monday night, I went outside my driveway, was doing something. I heard the ice cream truck. He was like driving by the street, and I'm like, What the fuck? It was like 7:30 at night. I'm like, are most kids that are getting ice cream already in fucking bed right now?
And you
like,
thought of Clint Howard killing motherfuckers.
I always think of that movie when I see those ice cream trucks,
exactly.
Man.
Exactly. And, you know, something funny that I'd never put it up on the website, but I'll put it up soon. There's an episode of Monster Vision that features the ice cream man. I actually have a copy of it. I could throw it up on the website. And it's a really, really cool episode because Clint Howard actually stops by and talks to Joe Bob Briggs. And he gives a little insight into the film.
That's pretty cool.
And one of the things that he says is that when he was when he would drive the set in the morning, the whole way he would scream. So he'd get his voice all gravelly for shooting. So he would drive five people with his windows open. And he'd just be screaming like a madman. He already looks weird because he's Clint fucking Howard.
And yeah, that's great.
People are looking at him like he's a goddamn lunatic.
This is why we need like an awesome special edition Blu-ray of Ice Cream Man.
Right? I think Lionsgate owns it.
Because, you know, Clint Howard would be happier than hell to retell those stories or even grab that audio and put that or that whole thing as a special feature on there or something like that.
Yeah,
That'd be fucking cool, man. But even having new insight to Clint Howard, man, would be fucking great, man.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that you...
I bet he just has great stories, man, because he's a really quirky dude.
Yeah.
And I bet you just can recall the weirdest shit. And I bet you, like, it's totally contrived, though. I bet you at times, too. You know, he'll start telling the story. Just like, I don't really know if that actually happened, but who cares? We're going to roll with it. You know, just oddball Clint Howard stuff. So,
yeah. That film has wrapped shooting and it's supposed to go complete post production this year. It seems like a campy little horror film. After that, we have Two Lava, Two Lantula. That's right, a sequel to Mike Mendez's Lavalantula. This one is not directed by Mike Mendez, but is pretty ludicrous in its name of Two Lava, Two Lantula.
Two Lava, Two Lantula. It's the fucking stupidest title ever. That title is so stupid.
Oh, man. Oh. Yeah, get moods. If for $1 million, we're playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire right now. All right. On what network? Will Two Lava, Two Lantula air on August 6th? What network would that be?
On the Sci-Fi Network?
You want $1 million, dude?
Sci-Fi it is, yes, man. Sci-Fi for the sci-fi win. Sci-Fi.
What?
Man, it's so funny, too. I was just watching Matt's last Top 10 Tuesday video, and he did a Top 10 Spider video, and of course he had Lavalantula on there. That's what got me laughing. I'm like, really? They're making a sequel? But it only makes sense, because don't they make sequels to all their goddamn fucking movies on there?
Pretty much.
They really do, man. It seems like they have sequels to everything on Sci-Fi. It's crazy. But yeah. He said it's actually pretty good, but then again, it is Matt, though, right? You know, the king of the – he loves the shitty creature features.
Yeah, I can't – I cannot take his recommendations seriously. Have to take them with a grain of salt.
Me and Matt share this love for these terrible sci-fi bullshit. But I wish I could get more of them though, because I've been wanting to see that one, but it's like way too expensive. I'm like, you're going to charge like $20 for Lavalantula on DVD here? You do realize that's what it costs to make the damn film.
That's right? Ridiculous.
Yeah, I know. So I don't get to see a lot of them because we just don't have sci-fi anymore. It's weird, but –
So yeah. After that, we have Day of the Dead remake. This was announced probably a year or two ago. Apparently, filming has begun. This is the second Day of the Dead remake. I forgot about the first one.
Yeah, there's Day of the Dead remake, and then they made a sequel to the remake. And now this is a full-blown remake again?
Was the sequel a sequel to the remake? I always thought it was a sequel to the original.
I think the sequel was... I can't even fucking remember. Was it the sequel to the remake or the sequel to the original? Was it supposed to be I can't remember the whole story. I haven't seen it in such a long time, but you know what? You're probably right. It probably is a sequel to the original. In hindsight, who the hell would make a sequel to that shitty remake?
Actually, you know what, dude? Because I remember now. It is a sequel to the original. It came out in 2005, and then the remake came out in 2008, of course, starring Nick Cannon, directed by Steve Miner, oddly enough.
Day of the Dead 2. Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because the original one was, or the Day of the Dead 2 was put out by Anchor Bay back in those days, wasn't it?
I think Day of the Dead 2 was owned by the same people who made Creepshow 3. Somehow they got the rights to these like Romero films.
What is going on?
And made these shitty sequels.
Poor Romero with all his rights problems in his career, right? You know, yeah. That's terrible. Okay. That makes a little more sense. I knew there was something there. So it did come up before. Makes more sense. So this is like a bona fide remake of the original Day of the Dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
Crazy. So they're remaking this again. Hopefully it's like on a better budget with better actors, and well, let's try to get a better story this time.
I think it's being done by the people who did Chainsaw 3D, honestly.
Okay, well, I guess we know the type of production value. We're going to have a very contrived story in it then, and
if you're curious, Moods, to the company that did the original Day of the Dead 2, it's the same company that put out such classics as Ghoulies Go to College, Horror 102 Endgame, and the Day of the Dead remake.
What the fuck? Okay, there's the quality.
Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. They made a sequel, Horror 102 Endgame, to a film that was not even good to begin with. Have you ever seen Horror 101, Moods?
I have seen Horror 101, and it was so fucking bad.
Terrible. So bad. It looked like a college kid film.
I have that fucking double feature, man, the Anchor Bay double feature, and I could never bring myself to watch a sequel because the first one was so horrendous. I was like, why did they even put that out? You know, and this is like original Anchor Bay, too, when they were putting out really good stuff.
Well, guess what, Moots? I have Horror 101 on VHS.
Damn.
Yeah. Have it on VHS. I've watched
it. Well, just put it this way. Just put it this way, man. Say after the show and you're still kind of buzzing from doing it, you're not tired and stuff, put in Horror 101. It'll put you right to sleep.
There you go.
Guaranteed.
Yeah. So that company, better than the sleeping pill. That company gets no credit. That is Taurus Entertainment.
Okay, yeah.
They actually did do some good work back in the day, though. Like, they distributed Sleepaway Camp and some like Two Evil Eyes theatrically back in the olden days.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So, with that said, let's move on here from Day of the Dead remake. We have Friday the 13th and Tales from the Dark Side. These are both the TV series, are getting complete series releases again, because there is complete series releases. And I know up in Canada, you mentioned that those things were really hard to get, Moods. Is that correct?
Not Tales from the Dark Side. It was more the Friday the 13th were really hard. I mean, for some odd reason, the seasons individually were always $30, $40. So I don't know what was up with that. Tales from the Dark Side, no, you could get for, you know, probably normal prices. So,
okay. Tales from the Dark Side, the individual seasons were about $10 a piece for a long time. I don't know what they were now. And the box, the complete series was about $40. Friday the 13th, it seemed to be that each of the individual releases were about $20 a piece, and you can get the complete series for about $30. I've seen it at, but it was expensive for a long time. It's almost like seems like this is the third release of it, because I swear there was like a cardboard version, and then there was like the plastic case versions, and now this new release.
So they're starting to re-release like all these older shows. Like, they just re-released American Gothic, didn't they?
Yeah.
Recently.
And so I think they did Thriller too.
Oh, they did Thriller also.
Yeah. Cause cool. I seen it at Walmart the other day. And, this is being done by CBS Home Entertainment and Paramount Home Media Distribution. I actually got a press release on this, which I was extremely confused about, because I've never been part of CBS Home Entertainment's press releases. So,
isn't that weird when that happens? Because I've gotten press releases from places too, and I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
I'm like, and I didn't, yeah.
I tell you, dude, the press release was like the most pitiful press release I've ever seen in my life. It literally says, CBS Home Entertainment and Paramount Home Media Distribution are releasing Friday the 13th, the complete series, and Tales from the Dark Side, the complete series, on September 6th. And then all it says is Friday the 13th, and it gives a synopsis of the show, and it says Tales from the Dark Side and a synopsis of the show. And that's it. There's no images, no anything. And I actually contacted the people, and I was like, is this DVD only? Is it Blu-ray? Do you have, you know, cover art? Do you have what these discs are going to look like? Do you have promotional stills? Do you have anything? And she was so like, strange, oh, I'm sorry, right? It is DVD only. And
that was a well put together press release, wasn't
it? She said it is DVD only, and right now we do not have any promotional stills or high res images for the release at this time. I'll get back to you at a future date. So it's happening, and it's happening in September, but it seems like they're building it from the damn ground up because they don't have anything.
So weird.
On a plus note, I'm hoping I get some review copies for those because that would be sick.
So if they're releasing the whole series, are they putting it into one package, or is it just being released separately in like a box set type deal?
Oh, I believe both series will be individual on their own, like complete series releases.
Okay. Yeah. So getting back to that Thriller box set, how did they re-release that? Because
season one.
Oh, they just they released it like that.
Yeah, it was season one.
Oh, okay. Cool. Yeah. Cool.
So after that, Scream Factory made what they consider big announcement. They're releasing Carrie on Blu-ray in this is sort of the future of what they're doing now, where they're releasing these. It's a 40th anniversary edition, and if you order it directly from their site, you get the alternate slipcover and both posters from the original slipcover and the alternate.
Now, honest to God, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that's inviting enough to order from them?
No, for the because extra I don't even like the first poster.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, obviously the art has to be good enough, but even if it was like fantastic and stuff, like, you know, the second slipcover, okay, the posters, I know people are big fans of the posters and stuff, but with this, what's the whole second slipcover thing about? To be honest.
You know what, like, it is, dude? I know exactly what the second slipcover thing is about. Okay. This is pure. It's actually smart. No, this is 100%. All right. This is what happened. It is my opinion, but it is right. It is 100% right. So what had happened was, ever since Scream Factory first came about, you go over to their Facebook page and they have sales, or, as releases come out, they'll be like, hey, I got this release and it didn't have a slipcover. Hey, I got this release and it didn't have a slipcover. Hey, are is this sale? Are these going to have slipcovers? Oh, Scream Factory has to release a full blown statement that says, you are guaranteed a slipcover when you order through us for the first 90 days of release. And we can say with great, feeling that if you order from somewhere else within the first 90 days, you will have, a slipcover. It's not guaranteed, but it's pretty probable, because we don't stop printing the slipcovers until 90 days after, whatever. And then you always hear during their sales, hey, will these have slipcovers? Hey, I didn't get a slipcover. How can I get a slipcover? You look on eBay, people are selling the slipcovers. They know that there's a market for the slipcovers. They have seen, based on our questions, based on the fans' questions about the slipcovers, it made them know, like, oh, people actually give a shit about this cardboard. And me personally, I've literally like bought the more expensive version off eBay because there's a picture and it has the slipcover on it. When the other ones just was a stock image and I wouldn't know if it had a slipcover. It's stupid fandom nonsense that they figured out a way to monetize. They're the first company to figure out a way to monetize the slipcover. And they've done it based on seeing. Awareness, paying attention to what's happening in the landscape, that people actually care about them. Because at the end of the day, it is retarded to care that much about a piece of cardboard. Now the bonus poster, that's actually like a selling point. Like if you want a limited to 300 poster, like the extra $5 is actually makes sense. You know, it's not, you're getting two posters now. Like I've always liked their poster idea. But this slipcover one is dumb. But it makes sense because they're it's smart. They're making money off of it. The Return of Living Dead one sold out in like fucking 48. It's a one day. It sold out in like 12 hours or something.
Yeah, one day.
And I bought it myself. I have the two slipcovers, which by the way, they did package it like appropriately. And I have the two posters. I thought it was going to be a one-time thing. Why the fuck I thought that? I have no idea. But apparently, they're probably going to do this with a lot of collector's editions moving forward.
I think that was probably a test, though. You know, we'll test this out with Return of Living Dead, see how well it goes. And then when it sold out in 12 hours, they're like, well, let's you know, obviously try this again. And obviously Carrie hasn't sold out yet, as far as I know, but it probably will.
One.
Yeah, I mean, there you go.
You're far into it.
They're selling two slip covers to a Jew. I mean, this is amazing.
Yeah, had the first poster been a little better, I would have considered buying it, because I do love Carrie. Like, it's become one of my top 10 favorite horror films of all time. I do own a Blu-ray of Carrie, but I will buy the second version because I'm interested in any special features that might be added. Maybe they do a Horrors Hallowed Grounds on it. Instantly gets me excited. This is a 4K scan, not the 2K scan from the previous version, which I think was the 2K scan. 3 hours of interviews and featurettes, tons of additional features. Carrie is Stephen King's first, you know, adaptation to film. It's an amazing movie. It's one of the most influential films of all time, according to us. It's an amazing movie. I love Carrie. I was not disappointed with this announcement, other than the fact that they hyped it, because it's like, oh, it's Carrie. Yeah, okay, you got Carrie. You said that you could have Carrie before. It's no surprise that you got Carrie now. But I'm down. Like, why not put like another, you know, version of Carrie out? Like, there's been a million already. Like, it's one of those films like Jaws that are going to keep getting additions, or like The Evil Dead. Like, people love those movies, and this one has apparently a better scan. So what the hell ever, you know? Like, it's not the most interesting thing in the world, but
I think that's why people are so upset, though. It's just, they're kind of getting tired of the releases that are getting, you know, getting that treatment over and over again, you know? Yeah. I mean, you know, there's the people out there that'll buy like 1,000 different copies of The Evil Dead and stuff. Maybe there's people out there that'll buy, you know, 1,000 different copies of Carrie also. I think it's just because it seems like it's getting so far away. And, you know, they do keep making statements that like all their cult titles and stuff that they're apparently not selling. This is what they're telling us, you know, and these are the titles that do sell. And I understand from a business standpoint that, you know, you do have to subsidize your, you know, what you got. I mean, really, these are the ones that are selling. Why not keep putting them out? I mean, but at the end of the day,
the thing is, Moods, they're not putting out the cult ones either. And that's what annoys me so much about that argument, is people are saying like, why can't you do both? Why do you have to do one or the other? Like, I don't understand that. That never made sense to me.
Well, just the latest, you know, whoever was on the Scream Factory page answering for Scream Factory, they listed off all those titles, and they're like, well, these are the type of titles that are more likely going to be coming out now, because they're the ones that sell. These ones didn't sell. And, you know, we tried and tried and tried with the cult titles, but they're not really selling too much, which, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, because you get all these people that are just, you know, they're wanting and they're voicing their opinions that they want these titles, but they're not selling. It's like everyone's bitching but not buying. You know, I mean, the fans have to do their part too. The fans have to do their part. That's what I'm saying. The fans have to do their part too. I mean, if we're going to sit there and scream that we want this obscure title from the 80s, you better be buying the fucking thing, because these guys are coming at us and saying straight up, these are the titles that didn't sell well. And if you look at them, they're pretty much all the cult titles. So it is kind of annoying. You know, I understand it from both point of views, from the fan and from a business aspect also. But, you know, at the same time, for me, you know, I'm just like, you know, okay, cool.
I mean, you can look at this fact. This is fact. You can go over to Scream Factory's Facebook page, and when they announce some obscure title that I've never heard of, and you look at the comments on it, there's a handful of hardcores out there that are like, oh sweet, like I haven't seen this since the 80s. You see, when they announce something like Carrie, there's 600 fucking comments talking about it. It's not that hard to realize what's happening. However, I will say one thing.
Well, yeah,
I am no longer – I used to collect every Scream Factory, not doing it anymore. I gave it up. The reason is because one of the things is they are the reason it some people do have a good argument with this. This is fact. They say that the cult films aren't selling. Okay, that's true. But that's also what my argument is, that Scream Factory has done nothing to help them sell. I left a long comment on their Facebook page because I noticed a few things. One, when Scream Factory first came around, that everybody was super psyched. Everybody was so high on them. Nobody, they couldn't do wrong. They announced, I remember, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, Terror Train, The Funhouse, The Island, Death Valley. And then we got into like the, you know, Phantasm. And, you know, they announced a couple titles right away. Two of what I would consider the cult titles were The Island and Death Valley. They have said before that those titles have sold well. Another one that was in the top, the first 20, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Another one that was in the first 20, The Video Dead and Terrorvision. All of those titles sold really well. One thing that I've noticed is that was back at a time where when they would announce a non-collector's edition, they would announce a non-main big title, it was at like $15. Now it's $21, $22, the same price as the collector's edition. On top of that, they're putting out four times the amount of films. They put out two a month back then. And so you're literally making people decide, okay, should I go with the cult one or should I go with the mainstream one? Well,
yeah, obviously it's like
the almost the one that's got the slipcover and the collector's edition and all the special features over, because I can only afford so much. Now, if it was only two films being released, or if it was only $15, like, I'm not like, do you believe the idea that Species 3 and 4 in a double feature was $22 on Amazon on pre-order is ludicrous. Like, and not even on pre-order, on release. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's so they are hurting themselves. So that make no mistake about it. This is partially their fault too. But at the end of the day, big titles like Carrie are always going to sell. That's not going to change. And Zach brings up this point time and time again. It drives me crazy. He says, well, Synapse and Blue Underground and Grindhouse Releasings, they make a living selling these cult titles. Zach, I'm sorry, bro, but comparing those little companies to Shout Factory, who has hundreds and hundreds of employees compared to, you know, three guys that are running the entire company, that they have to bring in like crazy revenue. Scream Factory is a sub company of Shout Factory. Blue Underground doesn't have these like sub companies, entire company under it. Now they started Shout Select. Like, it is this giant thing. They have their own streaming website, you know? Like, these guys need to bring in way more money than you know, the Synapse of the world. And that's why they're when they see these titles not making, like, yeah, if that title, I bet you any of these titles,
they kind of flooded the market.
Synapse, that would be a good day for Synapse, but it's not for Scream Factory or Shout Factory, because they need more than that. And you know, what are you gonna do? I mean, that's like, we'll get into it later with Synapse and the shenanigans they're pulling, but Scream Factory has known to pull their damn shenanigans too, and I think this slipcover thing is stupid.
But they're kind of like, you know, like you said, they are their worst enemy right now, because they've kind of flooded the market too with, I mean, is there really a point in releasing 8-9 titles a month? You know, and like you said, ultimately it is making people choose, and they're probably going to start buying these lesser ones, which happens to be what these IFC titles now are, probably the more cheaper ones, right? I mean, and why? Because they're in Walmarts too?
Yeah, the IFCs are all in Walmart. They're in Walmart.
This is why people are not buying these cult titles anymore. Because they see these ones, these are readily available, you know, in your Walmarts. They're cheaper. And that's why they're selling more. Because honestly, I mean,
it like really you said, is a different
you're
market,
not collecting.
Though.
I know, but at the same time, there is certain people, like even yourself, you've given up collecting all the Scream Factory titles. Totally makes sense, because they're fucking flooding you titles. They're putting out way too much stuff, dude. And this is the problem. And this is one of the biggest reasons.
But I'm
reasons
a rare person
had to
as
raise
well,
the price.
Though. I'm not, the normal people don't collect them all. Like, honestly, how many of us do we know that do? Three people in the entire circle of people we know that have tried to collect them all? There's not that many people who do, but it doesn't help. It doesn't help sell the cult ones, but maybe they're fine with that. Maybe
the company, this is the problem. Like you said, there's hundreds of employees, and this is exactly what they've done to themselves. They keep growing. They have another company, Select, you know, and with more,
they're making their own films. They just produced a goddamn film. Is Synapse producing a film?
Probably.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
that's what I'm saying.
Completely different.
that's another reason why the prices are going up too, because their company's getting bigger too. They have to keep, they have to keep above sea level. They have to keep up here. They can't
go
anywhere.
They have to stay in the green. They can't go in the red.
And that's the thing. That's why this deal with IFC is probably the best thing for them, because they sell a shit ton in Walmarts and stuff. And it's at the end of the day, there's multiple reasons why they're not selling, but I think it's because they're putting out way too much stuff. And these are just too readily available for the average person. They don't give a shit about these other titles and people are fed up. I mean, honestly, dude, I'm ready to throw in the fucking towel too. I'm getting.
I felt it from you too, and I think that. Listen, guys, this is at the end of the day. This is what we have to realize. This is not our little, you know, horror homie anymore. This is not a company where it's focused on the horror fan and the cult fan. It's now become more of a mainstream company.
I think people don't want to admit
that these titles sell. They don't want to admit that these IFC titles are doing big numbers, because they want to believe, like, they want a reason to say, like, you should be releasing these cult titles, like, and they want to hold on to this fantasy world that doesn't exist. Like, there's always going to be the company that makes a name for itself and picks up these titles. Like, a Grindhouse releasing, if you ask the owner that, hey, could you, would you rather have Shout Factory or keep doing what you're doing? I guarantee you they would want to be owning Shout Factory instead of Grindhouse Releasing. And it's just, you know, and that's why so many of these companies die off and don't succeed. And that's why so many of them go the way of Shout Factory. Look at Anchor Bay. Anchor Bay is the original model of what Shout Factory is doing now. They started with all the cults, and Anchor Bay did a really great job with all the special features and all the collector's editions and things. And what happened to Anchor Bay? They made a lot of money and
they used those hardcore fans to get into the, you know, into the non-horror fans that'll buy movies in Walmart.
Yeah, exactly. And that's
it's a stepping stone.
I mean, it's sad, but it's factual. And if they're going to, you know what? I'm just honestly happy that they are still releasing shit that I do care about, even though there's a lot of shit that I don't care about, like some of the IFC titles and things. And we're not saying they're all bad, because they're not. Like, a lot of them are good, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, I like Carrie. So I'm cool with there being a 4K transfer out. I might not pick it up day one, but, you know, I'll grab it eventually, and I'll grab all the cool, weird ones like Hellhole that I'm interested in too.
At the end of the day, man, this is all conversation, because, I mean, essentially what it's come down to is that Scream Factory at one time didn't really have that big direct competition until Arrow really started stepping up their game. And now Arrow is just, you know, to most people is the best there is right now, you know, on all levels and stuff. And, you know, I mean, it's just that conversation piece now, Arrow, Scream Factory kind of thing. I mean, most people are probably going Arrow. Because they limit their releases, and I think they do a really great job with them and stuff, and it's just, it is what it is now.
Yeah, but people start hating Arrow too. Just wait for it, because as they grow, they'll start doing things that people are unfans of, or they'll start picking up titles.
It already happened, because Arrow started out, I mean, Arrow's already gone through the transition, man. They have like three different fucking sub-labels to Arrow too. But Arrow started out as releasing just strictly cult films too. I mean, with their DVDs and stuff, they in conjunction with Cult Cinema Video, whatever the fuck it was. And that's all they were doing. They were customizing their artworks, and it was kind of this, you know, this fresh new cult look at these films and stuff. And what was it, last year and a half ago, they said, we're really going to cut back on cult films. And this hate already passed, you know, we're going to cut back on just
it's
going to
be bigger.
And, you know, and then they kind of started up with the new, new sub labels like Arrow, Drome, or I mean, what that's still called stuff, but you know what I'm, the Arrow, the one where they release like the old classic films stuff. The point is they have sub labels and stuff, but they don't release as much horror. They're starting to do it again. You know, they seem to be picking up a little bit more these days, and some pretty crazy titles, to be honest, but, who knows? I don't really know. They kind of go back and forth with Arrow too. So
I mean, Arrow does a fantastic job, 100%. Like, their releases are good. Like, they put more time and effort into them than I think most companies. Like, you can see by the way their special features are done, and just the way that everything looks, and the way they announce it. I don't know. It just seems more like high quality. One thing that I don't like about Arrow until recently is their cover art, which that they have been improving on greatly. You know, Arrow Video does release a lot of films that like I'm completely uninterested in once I start watching them. Like Bloodbath sucked. Like those movies are not good, and they're a lot worse than people, like, cause it's like Arrow, I swear people like won't be admit like that release is not very good. Especially for, you know, being a box set or whatever. It's an interesting historical thing. That's 100%. But those movies are not entertaining. So,
it has its market, man, because I've seen so many people say how much they love Bloodbath and stuff, and I'm not going to name specific names and stuff.
Well, I've heard Tom from the Horrors Ball mention it, and I was like, did I watch the same movie as him? Because he was like talking.
Oh no, Tom's talked that movie up for years. Huh, so, I remember him talking about that.
Honestly, when I first read that though, I was like, maybe I need to watch that shit again because I like felt like I missed out. I missed something that, you know, I watched it wrong or something, but. You know, like, okay, for example, man, like some of these films that I get from Arrow and I watch, like Contamination or something, like, yeah, they're it's cool that it got a release. And so these are not amazing movies though. Like, and you know, sometimes you'll get some from them, but that they are like these cult films, like is that people, the cool thing about the cult films is people haven't seen them, and people like Zach and people like you who have seen so many movies, like, yeah, of course you guys are going to get most excited for shit you haven't seen. But to me, I get most excited for fucking movies that are like amazing movies, like these, like Carrie and shit. Like Carrie is an amazing movie. You guys have been around for many more years than me, and you've fucking seen Carrie 1900 times, and you have probably
how you look at it though too, right? Like for me, you know, like, yeah, I want to see something that is a little more obscure that I don't have in my collection, because, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes I'm like, okay, well, I have a DVD of Carrie, I have a Blu-ray of Carrie, I'm like, do I need this extra ultra, you know? Like, I am a collector, but at the end of the day, it's like, it's still the film.
You 100% don't need it, and I know you're gonna buy it, which is, I don't know, I only own the one edition of Carrie, but you know, and even me, if it wasn't in my so lovable films, like top 10, I probably wouldn't get it. But I don't know, man. I'm just trying to say, like, sometimes I feel like the cult fan is a little ridiculous with the amount that they defend the cult life, because some of these cult films are not good movies. Like, they're interesting and they're curious. But you guys sometimes defend them like they're fucking these like juggernaut films, when they're like Contamination, for example, is just it's an okay movie. It's kind of
No, it's not. Contamination sucks, man. But it's a bad good movie, man. Like, I mean, yeah. I mean, Contamination was put out by Blue Underground. Like, we've seen that thing a million times. Like, you know, I mean, even when Contamination was announced, I was like, okay, you know. I didn't even get it at first. As a matter of fact, I got a copy without a fucking slipcover. So I just go show you that I didn't even get that one right away. But yeah, I know what you're saying, man. But it's all in taste though too, right? It's like, I know people that don't like giallos, and I'm just like, what? Like that blows my fucking mind. So,
well, I mean, giallos are just like, there's some that are really good, right? There's some that are really good. But there's a lot of them that are dumb and they're kind of fun.
There's a lot of really decent ones, man.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of them, but just based on the ones that I've seen, you know, like, I don't know, man. It is all in taste. It's all about what you like personally. I just feel like sometimes the people who are in love with all everything cult, it's more of like a.
I mean, that could be the
way
you're
looking
at it, though,
too. It's like a fucking. It annoys me sometimes because I'm like, if you like something mainstream, you're like, oh, like of course you like Carrie. Like, why? When is it bad to like something that's really good? And sometimes I'll get this shit, and I'll be like, these guys are so diehard cult underground. Like, it's the same thing with like a lot of. You know,
but those guys are the same guys that, you know, they have a whole collection of, you know, all the mainstream films too, but they just won't admit to themselves that they like them just as much, you know?
Yeah.
It is what it is, right? Like, I mean, they probably have all these films.
It's the same thing with the people who, you know, only like underground, like gore films or something, or like the hard box thing, you know? It's like that mentality where it's like, can't we just like everything that's cool?
Well, it's funny because I think that some people kind of get a little misled by, I remember the old extreme horror community on
YouTube. Yeah, like that too, man.
But it was funny because a lot of those guys, and again, I'm not going to sit here and drop names, but you know, a lot of those guys really enjoyed a lot of mainstream films and stuff like that. Like, I know for a fact they do. Right. And, you know, they were labeled as, oh, this is what they like, extreme, because that's what they were talking about at the time. That's what they were specifically into at that present moment. So I think it's the way you look at it and, you know, kind of the timing of it too. I mean, yeah, I'll sit here and defend films at the end of the day, but I'll tell you that I fucking love the Goonies. I don't know why I said
that. Yeah,
the Goonies.
Yeah, and that's why I actually fucking love you, dude, is because like at least you fucking do be liking like you like the shit, like you like all aspects, you know, not just like, it's just the mentality. Like I'm talking about a lot of the people that I was reading on Scream Factory's actual post, not anybody from our.
Swear to God, the people that post on that Facebook page they sit there all day just to argue.
Dude, I want to slap David Steinman so hard. Like, but I just want to kill that guy.
Does he not work? Because he's on there constantly. Every time someone makes a comment, his name is right underneath there replying to it. Like, yeah, dude, what the fuck, man?
It's so bad. It's so bad. It's like the most brown nosy like thing I've ever seen in my life.
I'm surprised Screen Factory hasn't stepped in, or whoever runs that the Facebook page.
No, they like it, man. He gets screeners from them and shit too.
God damn, man. Like, really? Like, he pisses off a lot of people on there, though. Yeah. And Screen Factory just a lot. They're just like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I know I've even heard people say, like, I don't even read the stuff on Screen Factory's page anymore because of that guy. And I'm like, I don't blame you. He's kind of annoying.
Yeah. But, I mean, dude, I don't know. Rant over. I was reading those posts, man. Those people on there. And it was just driving me crazy. I was like, these people are like do or die cult. Like there can be no other. Like, I'm just like, what the fuck?
And they're probably
14-year-olds
too. 14-year-olds just pretend.
I don't know, man. Anyway, yeah. So they fucking announced Carrie.
That's awesome. Yep.
That is the news.
Oh, that was the last piece of news? Okay. nice. Okay, well, how many pieces was there? We talked about like four things.
There's like six, I think.
That's crazy. That's so funny. Alrighty, so getting into mood swings and the DVD and Blu-ray releases for July 5th, 2016. And it looks like July is actually picking up. It seems like there's quite a few things coming out this next month. That is tickling my pickle a little bit, you know what I'm saying? First up here is a film that I actually didn't even know about being released by Kino. I'm assuming on the Kino Classics line, and it's called Absolution. Looks awesome, man. It's got Richard Burton in it. It's cool, man. Man, Kino has been putting out so much cool things, like a lot of films I've never heard of before. I'm just like, man, you know, like, and they're starring like a lot of, you know, people that you know and shit. I'm like, ah. They dig deep, man. They dig deep. That one looks cool. Finally, the American release of Blood and Black Lace from Arrow is dropping July 5th. So you want that. And I believe the Steelbook is coming out July 12th, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know why they're coming out different days, but Blood and Black Lace finally coming out July 5th. So pick it up. The transfer is beautiful. It's sexy. It's awesome. We reviewed it on here. So go check out that episode because it didn't get that much views. Bunch of assholes out there, right? Anyways, I digress. Next up here from Scream Factory, of course, because you can't have a weekly release party without some Scream Factories. And we have the Cabin Fever remake from IFC, of course, / Scream Factory. I have still yet to see the Cabin Fever remake. I know, JP, you obviously have. And you actually reviewed it on here, didn't you?
It was on the mini shots.
It was mini shots. That's what it was.
Five, I think.
That's right. So Cabin Fever
six.
Coming up.
Can't remember.
Yeah. Again, from Scream Factory and IFC, we got The Pack. Now, is this supposed to be a remake of the 70s movie, The Pack?
I'm just
kind of putting it in conjunction with Cabin Fever remake. It's just this film has the same name. I don't think it is. It just has the most unoriginal title, I guess, if it's not a remake. The Pack, killer dog film coming out from Scream Factory, IFC. Next up, we have a film called Parasite. I have no idea about this one. Parasite Maximum 2? Is that what it's called? I don't know.
The Maximum.
Is that what it is? Parasite them. Oh yeah, because this thing's all fucking written fucked up on here. Wow, $37.99 for this. So I'm assuming it has both films on here.
I think that it's an anime series.
Okay, I don't know anything about it. So
because it's 300 minutes long,
that would make sense. That would make sense. Yeah. And then we got one here coming out from Film Chess Media. Now, I think this movie is more of an action film, but I do know it is like a rape revenge film, and it's called Hell Hunters. I'm really stoked to check this out, man. This looks pretty cool. Film Chess, they just recently released Bloody Wednesday, which was a really cool film. Check that one out. But Hell Hunters, looks okay, I guess. I don't know. It's from the original 35mm print. Yeah. Then we got Holidays, the anthology horror film. Of course, got what short did Kevin Smith do on here? He did the Halloween one?
I believe so. This is getting a really quiet release.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Also, it's kind of creeping up. From what I've heard about this, it's pretty average, and apparently everyone's hating on Kevin Smith stuff. But then again, everyone hates on Kevin Smith in general, so it doesn't really surprise me. I'm still really curious to check this out, being an anthology series based on Holidays. So, I mean, I would usually say you can't go wrong with that, but apparently you can because it's getting bad reviews. But I'm still going to check it out for myself. This one right here has got an interesting name, The Lavenger Tapes. Kind of interesting.
It looks like H.P. Lovecrafty. Like I'm seeing like a tentacle monster or something.
Yeah, a little bit. It does. And you know, the weird thing is this is actually a Lionsgate film. Lionsgate's putting out this.
Yeah, Lionsgate pisses me off, man.
It's very interesting. Lionsgate doesn't put out a whole lot of horror films, but this one right here, I laughed at the title. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Me and My Mates Versus the Zombie Apocalypse.
Nope. Not even gonna. I can't even entertain watching that.
No, it doesn't even tell you who's releasing this on Amazon. Isn't that fun?
It's one of those things. It got like everything I hate. It has the stupid looking cover that we've seen a million times, where you can tell it's like a zombie comedy. It's also a zombie comedy, which I hate. It's also something versus something in a zombie apocalypse, which is always annoying to me. It looks British as fuck because they say Me and My Mates, which is also something that I'm not particularly usually interested in. And it just looks dreadful. It looks terrible.
So basically what's going to happen here is this is going to be the ZomCom of the year. You know what's going to happen. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be like the next Cockneys vs. Zombies. I know how much you love that one.
Yeah.
So we got Volumes of Blood is listed on here. I believe this film has already came out from Legless Corpse. So, I mean, if it hasn't came out officially, maybe just on their website, it's supposed to be coming out on the 5th. I don't know. And then last up here, now this one made me laugh. I was like, are you kidding me? From BBC Home Entertainment. It's called Witchcraft. And it literally looks like The Witch. The cover just screams The Witch.
I'm thinking that this might be like a more of a like, I don't know, like dark or something because it's 200 minutes.
Yeah, it could be. It could be actually.
But yeah. Oh, by the way, when I said I don't really like British, I meant comedy.
British no, comedy. He actually just meant the whole country, like the whole continent. You know, he just the whole UK.
Yeah, I don't like British comedy like very much at all.
Well, it's because it's like it's different. It's kind of dry at times, and it's just a totally different thing. I can see why people don't get it, but so you're not a big fan like Monty Python and stuff like that.
No.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely an acquired taste. I mean, I dig it though. It's pretty funny. But that is going to do it for the DVD and Blu-ray releases. Now my release of the week.
Easy week, man.
It's so easy. You got to go with Arrow's Blood and Black Lace. I do have this release already, and it's just so fantastic, man. It's got great features on it. The transfer is fantastic. It sounds, looks great, of course. The features are great on it. It even comes with the short called Yellow. It's like a little Neo Giallo. It's about 30 minutes long or whatever, and it's fantastic. It's beautiful. It's very, very beautiful and stylish. So when you get this release, check that out.
Out of like the handful of screeners I got from Arrow recently, I did not get Blood and Black Lace. I was really bummed out about that.
Oh, interesting.
I got a bunch of other things. Did not get Blood and Black Lace.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was like the one that I wanted.
I'd be emailing those guys back and be like, come on, man. Blood and Black Lace. You got to hook a brother up, man.
Yeah.
But you got some good ones, though, man. You can't really complain.
Well,
shit.
I am excited for the, I think it's a Jack Hill film, the cheerleader one.
Yeah, man. Anything Jack Hill, you got to get excited for. The guy's like the king of exploitation.
And the other one is Suitor, which it does not look up my alley that much because it's like not a horror film and stuff.
I don't even really know much about that one, to be honest.
I think it's like a noir.
Oh, man. I like some noirs.
Yeah, I do too, but just, you know, not for like review purposes.
True that. All right, so I think what we're going to do, I think we do have one voicemail, but what we're going to do is we're going to actually just kind of bypass it this week until we get more.
Yep, going to save it.
So yeah, we're just going to save it till next week. So hopefully we get – or till next show, and hopefully we get some more voicemails or questions or whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, that's a regular part of the show, and usually we like to have, you know, probably at least three before we – do them. We don't really always do just like one. If you want to leave a voicemail, you can do so at 724-426-6665.
Yeah. 6665. Yeah. All right. So we do have a knowledge segment for this week, and JP kind of gave a little hidden prelude to it a little bit there. So this week
I already like wasted all my rant in me.
God, there's got to be a little more. Oh man. Okay. So
he said there's got to be a little more.
there's got to be like this is fucking. This is actually kind of funny. So basically, what the knowledge segment is this week is we're gonna talk about Synapse releasing Tenebrae on the regular format. And of course, this comes after the fact of them saying that they had no plans to release Tenebrae other than the Steelbook edition. And I know I don't recall what episode it was, but I said bullshit on here, and I said for sure they're gonna fucking do this, and they're gonna fuck all the fans and alienate them to death. And I think this is exactly what they're doing. People are like, "Are you?" Everyone's so up in arms right now. They're just kind of laughing about it, and I'm going, "Told you so." So like what the fuck is going on with this, man? Is this just a new thing that they're doing, going, you know, maybe we'll try to trick the fans, or like, or is it a sales thing? Is Tenebrae not selling that well? And they're like,
no,
man,
that's not what it is, man.
The one thing I did find interesting about this release is that when Demons Steelbooks came out, the special features were exclusive to that. And then they dropped the regular standard editions, and it didn't have the features. So basically what that became was the Steelbook became the premium product. They dropped the regular releases
which is fine.
Now, this is a different story because they straight up told people that they're not going to release these standard editions. And then they do, you know, way after the fact. And I'm like, is there a specific timing in this? Because it just seemed odd to me that I completely was like, no, they're going to totally release these, man.
Yeah. So Synapse Films, often loved by many, including yourself, Moods.
Yeah.
I don't think they ever really did anything that pissed people off too bad thus far. So they announced Tenebrae. They announced a bunch of Argento films. This is going back a long time now.
Phenomena and Suspiria.
Yes, and Tenebrae. And everybody was waiting for them for a long time, and they gave updates here and there, and it did seem like Tenebrae was getting close to be announced, and I even remember telling Moods, like, I can't wait for this because I want to get as many Argento films on Blu-ray as I can. I kind of do that with all the big directors. Like, if there's a Blu-ray release, like, I'll get that for like all the Carpenters, Craven, stuff like that. Just because I want to see these people's work in high quality. And I was so excited for it because I've never seen any of these three films. And they finally, the day came where they announced Tenebrae. And what had happened was they said it's going to be limited to 3,000? 3,000 steelbook editions of Tenebrae exclusive to Synapse.com and Grindhouse.
Diabolic
DVD.com. Okay. That, that's all right. It's limited. That scares me a little bit. Yeah. So what's the price tag on that? What was it, $60?
It was
50, 60?
49 on Diablo. I think it was 45 on the website.
Okay. Plus the $5 shipping, $50. Because you have to include that in your initial price. Definitely. Because if it's exclusive to there, you cannot get it without paying that shipping. You know what I'm saying? So that's just part of the price at that point. And so that's not the problem, that it's limited so much. It is kind of the problem, because I hate limited things. Had they said it's limited, but we're going to put out another edition, a lesser edition, a non-premium edition, if you will, sometime down the line, then that would be another thing. But what had happened was they were saying there's no plans at this time to release another version of Tenebrae in the near future. And then one post, and I should have dug it up.
Even screenshots of this, it was even posted after.
One, they answered this question a bunch of times. At this time, we're not having plans to do another version. At this time, we do not have any plans. Bunch of times they said that. But one specific time, Synapse Films themselves said there will not be another version.
I remember that. Yep.
And to me, that's when we came back and
I said bullshit
again, and we said, okay, so maybe it changes things a little bit. If there's not going to be another version, then they're not honey dicking us into buying this one and then also release another version and sell more of those. And, you know, so they said not even 6 months ago. It wasn't even 6 months ago that they said that, right? Mm-hmm. And they already have another edition ready to go. It's lies. It's purely lies. Now, does it make sense for a money standpoint? Is it going to get you more money in the end doing it this way? Yes, of course it is. But there's a certain point where it becomes morally wrong. Because what happened was they released this steelbook. And they say it's only going to be this steelbook. So they sell a lot of them because people are like, yo, we need this thing. Okay. I don't think that they sold as many as they said, but I also do think they sold a lot of them. I would probably say there was probably a couple hundred left as of right now, in my opinion, based on how many people I've seen get it and how excited people were for it. Mm-hmm. And then recently they moved it off of the website and said, guys, we're so low in quantity that you can no longer get it off the website. You have to call and order it. Okay, first of all, that makes absolutely 100% no sense.
Isn't it the exact same fucking thing?
Have they
you're
done
still,
that?
You're still dealing with you. It's your listen, website. It's your listen. Fucking. It's
okay, your there's fault. So many reasons why that's stupid. One, that they've never sense. Done it before.
Yeah.
All right. So two, if you're not worried, and why would you be worried about it, right? If it's out of print and there are no more, you can't sell it on your site because let's say your argument is that, oh, if we sell it on our site and they buy more than we have left because we keep, for some reason can't have a fucking stocking thing on our website to let us know how many we have in stock, even though every fucking website, including our own, if we want to sell something, has that option. I'm talking about the 22 Shots of Moods and Horror. .com. Like, we can do that. We can create a stock for the amount of items we have to sell. So let's just say that your website's in like built in the 1900s and you can't do that. Well, then why aren't you worried about any of your other titles selling out and not having enough to fulfill orders? Because it's bullshit. It's a tactic to get people to buy up what they thought was, okay, let's just, for example, we have 500 left. This is hypothetical. Okay, if we can get these 500 gone real quick, that would be pretty cool. So let's say there's so low amounts that we had to take it off the site. You have to call in. And let's just hope that 500 people think they're the like last three people. It's like, oh, shit, I got one. I was like three of us got this, and I was one of them. Meanwhile, like 500 people actually called in to get one. You know, and then it didn't go as planned, and maybe only 300 people called in. So now they're standing there stupid. It's been like a month, and you can still get it. Did they sell out? Is it out now, or is it still available?
I don't think it's sold out.
I think it's still available. I haven't seen them say it's sold out. So you're telling me that it was so low, because so low to me makes it seem like it's, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, maybe 30, maybe 50 at the most, right? And you're telling me you haven't sold 50 of them in like a month or 2 months since you posted that? It's ridiculous. There was more than that. I do think that it sold way more than the Demons copies. And why did it sell more? Well, honestly, I think that it does have a lot to do with the way that the tactic that they used, which was saying that they're not going to release another version. Me and everybody who listened to us talk about it knew that this was going to fucking happen. And that's what pisses me off, because it's like if they kept saying at this time, well, then it's like, okay, they're bullshitting us, but you know, they're not lying. They're bullshitting to us, but they're not lying. When you flat out say there will not be another version, and in a 6 month time span, there's another fucking version. Are you kidding me? You just flat out lied.
Yeah, that's from where I come from, man. That's a straight up lie.
Yeah. You know, if it happened like 2 years down the road, I'd be like, okay, that's fine. You know, like it's been a while. Like it just makes you
look at the situation and go, they knew right from the start that they were going to release a standard.
Because 100% they knew it. They knew that they were going to,
it's too close in time. Okay. You released Tenebrae over here and now they just announced a release in the standard. They knew from day one that this was coming. Fucking business. It's shady goddamn business, and we called their asses out, and I fucking knew this was going to happen, man. So did you. We knew it.
Lying is involved in pushing things. It always is. Like if you
do these guys forget that when they answer a question online, that it's saved there, man. People are taking screenshots. It's, you know, it's for this reference.
Yeah, but the,
they're like, totally caught every fucking time.
Lying is 100% needed to run a business, but there's certain ways to do it, like exaggerating or misguiding.
I don't lie when I run my business.
Well, not like that, dude. But what I'm saying is, if you say not at this time, well, that's not necessarily a lie, right?
That's the way to do it. All in how you word
Everybody's
it.
Everybody's gonna say something, from the dime bag dealer who says that his weed's fire to the company that sells the nutrition shakes that only have 19 bananas instead of 20 in them. You know what I'm saying? There's always going to be a little truth exaggerating or just avoiding a question in general, like chewing it off by saying not at this time. That's basically saying like, okay, there is, but you know, you're not going to tell us, which is fine. That's legit business practice. Like every PR person in the world will do that.
Yeah.
When you come out and say there will not be another version and it happens right within like, it's fucking, the other version hasn't even sold out yet. And you announced it. That's bullshit.
It's a low blow.
On a positive note though, I'm happy because I will buy this new version, even though I shouldn't, because it just over principle. I knew that this was going to happen.
Well, the bonus thing, and quite literally the bonus, is that you're just getting the same disc from the Steelbook.
Yeah,
it's not like the Demons where you're getting no features.
The soundtrack and the Steelbook, which honestly, I don't care about the Steelbook. The soundtrack would be nice, but I could live without it. My Bird with the Crystal Plumage Blu-ray doesn't have the soundtrack that I'm.
Yeah, but you're still getting the documentary and things like that. So
yeah,
but yeah.
The people that should be mad are the people that bought that Steelbook.
Exactly. Yeah, they got duped into it, man. There's 3,000 copies, and that's all there's ever going to be from Synapse Films.
And what sucks, dude, is like. Like you can't talk to these people. Like these people should have to come out and answer that. They should be on this show right now explaining themselves and admitting that that's what they did. Because if they,
but, you know,
what if they came out and flat out said like, it was a business tactic, our company was hurting, we needed to make some buck, we spent a lot of money on these transfers, we had to make it successful, and so we lied a little bit. Like I would be like,
but all what right. do you mean? What do you mean? Lied a little bit? Like lying is still lying if it's a little bit or a lot.
If they were honest about them lying, I would respect it a little bit more than them just fucking.
Dude, if they came out and just said, "Yeah, man, sorry guys, we were totally lying. We had plans to do this the whole time," I'd be like, "Holy fuck, dude, that's pretty noble."
Yeah, but
I mean, you can laugh it off. But it's like, I mean, that's in a perfect world. That's never going to happen, you know. And
yeah, but another thing, dude. People like Synapse did take a lot of shit from our group page, but they did not get nearly the amount of shit that like Scream Factory gets when they announce Carrie. And that's once again shows you how much bigger of a company Scream Factory and Shout Factory is than Synapse.
Oh, for, of course.
But I'm not cool with this. But you know, this is the one time. This is I'm willing to forgive and forget. If they do this with Suspiria, if they do this with Phenomena, I will fucking boycott Synapse like I do fucking Bill from Code Red. Straight up, I ain't even playing.
Yeah, it's shady, man. Shady. But I mean, it's almost so ridiculous. I'm laughing about it still.
Ugh.
You know, it's just like I fucking knew this was gonna. When I saw, I woke up in the morning, I saw the post, and I was like, I started laughing out loud to myself. I'm like, oh, there it is. Yep, of course. And I was like, yeah, can't wait for this one to blow up. Read all the comments, man. I don't know how many people from our page bought that steelbook, but I know there was a couple, and it's like, shit. I wanted to hear from them, brothers. How do you feel about this? How do you feel about getting duped into buying a piece of metal?
Brandon bought it.
Brandon did buy it. That's right. That's right. Yeah. That lonely Jew, Brandon. Jesus. He even called me while we were recording tonight.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So that's knowledge. We just dropped it. Bunch of bullshit.
It is, man. And basically what this comes down to is we called it. We're right.
Of course Synapse we're right. It wrong. Was like, I mean, I would love to say that we're genius and we came up with something crazy idea, but honestly, like every fucking person could see that that's what they were doing. And that's what makes infuriating that they lied to us, because they lied to our face when we knew that they were doing that. And they thought, and in order for them to think we would believe it, they would think that they would have to think that we're stupid, which makes me way more mad that they think that we were stupid.
Exactly. I mean, we've come up with lots of brilliant ideas on this show, man. You know, the purge on a boat, the digital ring. Maybe that thing was fucking awesome.
That
I'm never gonna let those die, man. Those are brilliant. Those are great. But anyways, Synapse, we're pissed off. So you guys can go fuck yourselves right now.
Straight up.
And that's knowledge. All right. So getting into the coroner's report. From Rue Morgue Magazine, Weird Stats and Morbid Facts. I literally just put no effort into this line. I grabbed the first Rue Morgue and I was like reading through it. I'm like, I know for a fact I've read a couple of these out before. I'm like, shit, which one do I do? So I like completely forgot to grab one. So, but I'm not letting it die because I like doing these. They're always funny to me and kind of stupid at the same time, right? But they are facts. That's what makes them fun, is it not? You don't have to answer that, JP. You sleeping?
Okay. Yep.
All right. A contemporary Australian urban legend has it that if a driver accelerates to 111 miles per hour on Lemon Tree Passage Road between Newcastle and Sydney, they will find themselves pursued by a motorcycle riding ghost, which is alleged to appear as a bright white light in the driver's rearview mirror.
That is ridiculous. That's dude, the fucking cops pulling you over.
Yeah, that's exactly what I fucking thought when I read this. I'm like, are you sure?
You know what it is? Some little precinct in Sydney is like, their numbers are down. They got to get their quota up, and they're like, hey, let's write into this magazine and tell people about this legend so they speed through our town so we can pull them over and write them tickets.
It just makes me want to go to Australia and just do that. Just hit 111 and be like, okay, where's that motherfucker? I don't know, man. I just, you know how it is. But anyways, guys, that is Mood Swings, and getting into the, what we watch portion of the show, which isn't really that. It's more segments this week.
Yep. Just segments.
Just segments this week. So
I'll go first, homie. All right, guys, this time I'm going to be doing a Horror 101.
Welcome to Horror 101.
Of course, this is where I review a documentary, horror-related-ish. This one is. It's called The Fear of 13 from the year 2015. This is a documentary that's on Netflix. Now, it is not a horror documentary per se, but I thought it was fitting with this episode since it is about a serial killer, and I guess not serial killer, but a murderer. A convicted murderer who has spent 23 years on death row tells his story. So this one starts out with a very peculiar man. he tells a story in which when he first got sent to, you know, maximum security prison, death row, how basically everything that was happening was just happening. And he couldn't talk. He couldn't say anything because they were real strict on the amount of volume. Like, he wasn't allowed to talk, essentially. And all of a sudden he starts telling a story about two black males who were like lovers, and they had been together from outside of prison. The one got sent to prison, the other one committed crimes just so he'd be with him. And about how they were splitting them up, and they started singing this song when it was all supposed to be quiet and shit. And this is just, it's coming out of nowhere. You're like, what the fuck is this about? Like, why is he telling this random story from like the beginning of the movie? And then that's when you realize, like, oh, this is going to be very artsy. This is going to be an artsy documentary. And he proceeds to tell you all these different stories that has happened to him in sort of an odd order. It's not a linear timeline, like, oh, I started out this way and then this happened to me and then I got into this and then I did this and that's when I first spent time in jail and that's when I got tried for murder and stuff. It's not in that order. It's kind of all over the place. But it makes you more interested in the story. And I will tell you right now, guys, this shit is beautiful. Like, this is an interesting story from a guy who spent 23 years on death row. And you do start to question, because he did have a lot of interesting things happen in his case. First of all, he got in trouble a lot when he was younger. He stole cars. He was a car thief in the 70s. He got in trouble for that. He basically escaped prison before, and he got in trouble for that. It's the timeline on the escape thing is kind of weird. I don't know where it actually fits into the story, but and then you learn a little bit more about his early child life, and by the end of it you're just like, holy shit, like, I didn't even expect that ending, which is kind of interesting for a documentary, right? And two, there's this one core thing that happens to him that does still feel like it's kind of out of nowhere when he tells the story, yet they've been teasing it the entire time, which is kind of interesting, the way they kind of played that out. Very interesting the way that the story unfolds. I don't want to tell you guys anything because it's kind of amazing. Really, really good documentary, and, you know, not so much horror, but there is, you know, a murder and rape of a woman, in which is, you know, talked about, a killer, you know, it's not really horror, but it's more horror than Gummo. So I'm talking about it. The Fear of 13, that actually has a meaning, by the way. It's a super interesting film, but it's all told by narrations from the guy who's in prison. It's sitting down, he's telling the story, and he's so eloquent. Like, this guy couldn't read when he went to prison, and he learned how to read in prison, like, kind of taught himself, and he, like, amassed this amazing vocabulary and way of talking from reading books for 23 years, because that's all he did. And he is a really good storyteller, guys, like, really good. I give this thing a 9 out of 10. Very solid. Check it out.
Wow.
It's on Netflix.
Crazy. Sounds really cool, man. Sounds really cool.
It really is.
You had me intrigued when you said, wow, I wasn't expecting that ending.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I wasn't.
Dale Palmer, director of the X-rated films Hot Summer in the City, Erotic Adventures of Candy, Candy Goes to Hollywood, and coming soon, The Longest Foot, starring John Holmes.
Hi, I'm Gail Palmer. I've been hired by Stallion Releasing Company to supervise the editing of this new X-rated film, The Italian Stallion, with Sylvester Stallone in the starring role as Stud.
All right, guys. So my Italian Stallion for the week is coming from 1972. It's called Luciferina Demon Lover, or also The Devil's Lover. I think it's titled under IMDb as The Devil's Lover, released by Maya Communications. This is kind of like one of those low grade, I don't know what you want to say, like, satanic type films. I wouldn't even go as far to even say that, really. This is kind of a strange one. Basically, it's about these three girls led by this girl named Helga, played by Rosalba Neri. She's in tons of Italian films, man. Just sexy, sexy. If you've watched as many as Italian films I have, you'll probably recognize her in quite a few films, especially some sleazy Jess Franco stuff. But basically, they go to this castle that was built like in the 16th century, and they want to find out if the rumors are true about this castle. Apparently, the urban legend is with this castle is that it's actually the house of where the devil actually lives, kind of thing. So they want to kind of go there and do some research and things like that.
Does Ty West live there?
Does Ty West live there? Maybe. But anyways, so they go to this house and they ask the people there if they could, you know, have some hospitality and actually stay the night and, you know, kind of do some things. And of course they accept, you know, that the girls, they can stay there and stuff. And, basically what happens is Helga's, you know, she's in the castle and she comes across this painting of this person that looks identical to her. And, you know, she goes down for her sleep or whatever. And then she kind of falls into this deep sleep where it takes her back into the times of, you know, when this thing was built, like in back into the 16th century, where your story kind of develops. And, you know, she's supposed to be getting married to this guy. And what happens is this guy looks in through the window and sees her in her wedding gown. And I guess, you know, in, you know, myth or whatever, in legend, if someone sees a bride in her dress before she gets married, or I should say a male, if he sees her, you know, it's bad luck. It's really, really bad luck. But it turns out this person that's looking in her window actually was the devil. And then you got this other really kind of strange subplot going on in the film too, with one of her friends that she showed up to the castle with, is plotting to kill her because she loves the to be husband. It's got this really weird kind of subplot that just really makes no sense. And then all these kind of bizarre scenes happen with these really strange orgies and things like that. And, yeah, so what happens is the devil wants Helga to kill her husband on their day of the wedding so he can actually take her. That's kind of the point of why he peeks in on her before she's getting married. So that is the setup to the film. This is a really short film. It only runs about 77 minutes, and it's just got this really, really snail pacing to it. It's just really fucking boring, man. Like, there's really nothing happening. Like, you get this huge setup and then really nothing develops. Like, you get all this kind of crazy scenes with these characters that are just talking all this crazy gibberish and stuff. It's just, it's one of those films where you're like, okay, waiting for something to happen. Okay, where's the kills? Where's the sex? Where's the boobs? You know, oddly enough, man, there's like no blood, no gore. There's really not even a lot of sex and nudity in this one, even though there's like a really kind of random orgy in this too. It's really strange. It's an eerie film. I really like the sets or the, you know, the locations used. They used like a real castle and stuff like that. It was kind of cool. And it does have this really strange early 70s satanic Italian feel to it. But they just don't capitalize on it. I think the acting in this is really terrible too. But it's just the narrative. It's just all over the place. Like, they want to throw in not only the one subplot with her friend that wants to kill her, but they have another subplot and they're not really going anywhere. It's just really slowly paced and really boring. And, this one was dreadful to watch. It was terrible. It was a really, really terrible film. I can't really take anything away from this one except for Rosalba Neri. She's just amazing looking. That was about it. And you do get to see her boobs later on in the film, which is probably the highlight of the film in itself. The music was kind of strange too in this. It was really kind of off-putting at times. And you can tell that the director just really didn't have a lot of experience. And I actually looked him up, and this was like a second film. And you can tell the editing is really bad too. And the worst thing about this though was watching My Communications release of it. There was all these digital disasters going on in the film. Like, it would start farting, you know, having all these like digital imperfections in the like VHS transfer that they use. I think that happens too when you transfer from VHS to digital. You do get those imperfections sometimes, but it would show up spastically throughout the 77 minutes of this. It was terrible. So if I had to rate this one, I'm gonna give it a 3 out of 10. It was a really bad movie. Don't recommend this one at all. So yeah, I don't like all my Italian cult films now, do I?
Yeah.
It was terrible. It was bad. It was really, really fucking bad, man. Like, you should have seen the narrative. This thing was like all over the place. I'm just like, am I gonna get some kills? And then you get this like ridiculous scene where, I might as well say it, man, towards the end of the film, where this guy's coming to Helga's rescue or whatever. And, not even, it's actually the guy that he's kind of teamed up with the girl that's plotting to kill him. Anyways, he has like this sword fight with the devil and it's just ridiculous. The effects that they're using like that old 70s effect where they just kind of take the person out of the image and then put him somewhere else, you know, whatever the fuck you want to call it. It's so bad though. It's so laughable. I was having no fun with this movie. I can't even say I was having fun. I was having no fun. It is in Italian. It's subtitled and the dialogue is just atrocious. I think it was just, I don't even think it was probably translated properly. It was so bad, but yeah, not a good one. 3 out of 10.
All right, man. So, I guess it's that time, huh?
It is that time. It is that time for the featured reviews of episode 83. And we are doing, well, we said off the top of the show, man, serial killers this week. Henry Lee Lucas and Jeremy, I just called you Jeremy. JP had this bright idea of doing the Henry films 1 and 2 because, you know, of course, we're preparing for this 1996 show and got to kill two birds with one stone with the second film, which is awesome, right? That worked out.
Yeah, definitely.
Totally cool. But yeah, so of course, we're doing the classic, the classic film. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer from 1986, directed by John McNaughton. Now, it's interesting, too, because I think we talked about this once before about John McNaughton, how he became like a master of horror.
Yeah, very weird. John McNaughton, he did The Burrower, which Jeremy's a fan of. Yep. And then like nothing.
He did nothing until Masters of Horror. So he did this film, The Borrower, which was 5 years later. And then he did his Heckle's Tale, which is a really cool episode in season one.
It's actually my second favorite episode next to the classic that is Jennifer.
I would say Heckle's Tale was probably the most surprising episode too, because it's one of those ones.
So good.
it's one of those ones you kind of go into going, I don't know if I'm going to like this, but then it turns out to be way better than it is. But yeah, very strange that he became a master of horror, and I'm doing the quotations with my fingers right now. I don't know.
One real movie and like maybe two, I guess.
I know, it's so strange, right?
But if Jalen Landis can do it, anybody can do it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll get into the synopsis of this one. And thoughts on the movie?
Synopsis first, right?
There is actually really no synopsis to this. I mean, if you know what anything to do with Henry Lee Lucas, man, you know that basically he was a drifter. He would go around. And I mean, there's so many different stories about Henry Lee Lucas that you don't really know which ones are true, because he kind of fabricated and kind of downplayed himself in real life by telling a lot of stories and taking claim for a lot of murders that didn't happen and stuff. So, you know, these films are basically, you know, they're fiction and nonfiction at the same time kind of thing. So
it's not very biographical.
No, it's not at all, man. This is kind of just a portrayal of the psyche of Henry. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer is really what it is. It's just a picture of a serial killer. And, you know, essentially,
it's a good title.
Yeah, and it really is, because this film doesn't really have a narrative to it. It's kind of strange. But in this sense, it works so fucking good. It's brilliant how they did this film. Because it's so great, man. It's so great. I think it's so great how they did it, because they didn't really have to put in this, you know, the structured narrative to showcase, you know, to get into the mind of a serial killer. They portrayed it in so many different ways. Your thoughts on this one, man? I think right from the opening scenes in this film are just like phenomenal, man. Phenomenal. It's really interesting how this film was kind of how they did the opening scenes, though. I mean, the music's great, but they show a lot of carnage in this film and they don't show any of the kills at first. Did you find that a little interesting how they did that? They just show like this carnage and it's basically just a trail of Henry, you know, because he was a drifter, you know that. And, you know, they just kind of show this body here and this body there and stuff. And then it just kind of gets into it. I think that's like it's really effective, man. I think it's really effective.
So one thing that I was talking to my friend Carly, and I didn't get to watch this movie full the first time. I literally watched like the first 5 minutes and then stopped. But I told her right away whenever I see, I've seen other movies do this too, but it's something I always like, where it's just this, it cuts to Henry, it zooms out on a dead body, and then, you know, just a destroyed dead body laying in the woods, and then it cuts to Henry or something, and it cuts back to another dead body, and then, you know, it cuts to another dead body, and in all in different ways, all laying in different positions or up against something. I've always liked that. I think it's almost poetic.
It is poetic, and it's actually it's perfect how they did it too, because, you know, they knew about Henry's psyche, because they talk about it in the film too, like, you know, you don't use the same gun twice. You kill people in different ways to throw off the cops, you know, and things like that. And I like how they showed that in the beginning of the film, because they showed all these bodies dead in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could have been multiple killers, but that's right into his psyche, because they actually bring that up in dialogue in the film. I think it was a very, very poetic way of opening up the film. And it's just, it's so gritty, and it's like, it just hammers you right away. You're like, holy fuck, man, there's all these bodies and all these different, and they don't give you a location or a timeline. So these could have been like different places, because he was all over the place.
Yeah. They very much look like scary. Different places just by the scenery, but it does another thing too, which is it sets up our character, because we see this brutally dead woman laying in the woods with blood and just, you know, dead as hell. And it cuts to Henry, who is leaving a diner, and he's just talking in regular conversation casually. And what that does right away is this filmmaking 101, guys, is it sets up your character in a way that lets you know, okay, he's living normal, doing normal things, while this brutal, grisly murder thing had happened. And, you know, but it's just normal life as usual for him. So right away, it just lets you know what kind of character you're dealing with. You know, the one that doesn't feel remorse for his actions. It does not affect him in a negative way to have killed people. And right away, that is your classic serial killer right there.
The sociopathic
nature of them. And it sets it up in one scene. In 5 minutes, you're exactly set up on what kind of character you're dealing with.
I fucking love that scene, man. Like, you get this montage of dead bodies, and it just shows him having this casual conversation, paying for his cigarettes. And then he kind of walks out of the, I think it's the store, the diner, whatever. And it cuts back and they're dead. And it just shows him, man. Like, I think that's just, oh my God.
And another thing is you can do that scene differently too, where you show him in the scene with the bodies, and you show that he just killed them, but that portrays a different character right away.
Yeah.
That portrays like a,
this shows brutal, how he like, has
physical absolutely. murderer with, you know, it paints more of a, like a Jason Voorhees or that type of character.
Well, not it shows that he has absolutely no, it shows that he's a sociopath. He has no emotion, and he has no regard for any human life, because it shows him having this casual conversation, and then there's no reason to kill him. There's no hostility there whatsoever. He just kills because that's what he does. He's almost inhuman, and it shows that, and you get the picture right away. It's so fucking effective. It's like amazing. You know, I mean, he's that typical case where he can just kill somebody and go on with his day. Kill at will, man.
Yeah, so we're introduced to his friend Otis, Otis's sister, called, what's her name? Becky. Becky is her name, I believe, right?
Yeah, Becky is her name. It's funny too, because she actually looks like Becky from Roseanne.
A little bit, huh?
She completely does, man.
Yeah. So Becky is visiting Otis. This film does a lot of things. And one of the things that it does is we find out later with Becky's character, there's a lot of suggestion into this film and a lot of previous things that we don't know about but are hinted about. Like, we know a little bit about what happened in Becky's previous before the movie. We know a little bit into what Henry's previous before he was in the movie, you know, before what present day is happening. But at the same time, it's really unclear, because it feels like there's some lies there, and it feels like there's some untruths for sure with Henry.
Of course there is, man, because there's that really great scene. I mean, after, of course, Becky gets to Otis's house and stuff, and
they're introduced and they hang out a bit, and they're
having dinner. and stuff like that. And, you know, Otis goes off to do something, and which leaves Becky and Henry to have a conversation at the table. And, you know, Otis had mentioned to Becky that, you know, don't say anything, but Henry killed his mother. And of course, you know, they start conversating, Becky and Henry, and Becky brings it up that, you know, oh man, I heard that you killed your mother. And then it goes into this really, really great scene where, you know, they're playing cards and he kind of tells the story about how he killed his mom. But, you know, his line of reality is so blurred from the truth that he can't even decide if he shot his mother or stabbed his mother or whatever. But it doesn't really fucking matter to him, because all he knows is that he killed his mother.
Yeah. Right?
I love that. It's so effective. It really shows how he just doesn't really give a shit. Because generally, if I killed my mother, I would know how I killed her, because it would be it would burn to my mind. But with him, he's like, I don't really fucking care, man. I know what I did, and, you know, I know the end result. And it's just
that's not the whole thing, though, Moods, because that also, it also can mean that he's lying, that he didn't kill his mother.
Oh, of course. Of course. But I mean, you know, we're looking at him as someone that has no regard for, we've already seen, you know, the remnants of what, 7 or 8 bodies up into that point in the film that we know that he's directly responsible for, because that's what they're alluding to. Mm-hmm. So, but the way I take that scene is that he's so distant from reality that it doesn't even fucking matter to him. He's like, yeah, I shot her. I stabbed her, whatever. I mean, it just shows that he has no regard for life, that he doesn't even need to remember what he did. He doesn't care, because that's what he does. He's a drifter. He kills because that's what makes who he is. I mean, there's points in the film. It's like, hey man, you're having a bad time. Let's go out and do something.
See,
like, it's
also
all about
though,
the thrill. It's all about killing.
See, I kind of can see that as the way that it is too. But at the same time, I feel because he's a very intelligent person, he's very aware of what's happening, he's very controlling, manipulative. I almost think of it like the scene from the Dark Knight, where the Joker keeps talking about, you want to know how I got these scars, and he tells a different story every time. Uh-huh. And it's for the purpose of, with Henry, of just being in control of the situation and sort of
I can see that too. I can see that. I just see it because, knowing that he is a sociopath and he has no emotion, he's just like, he never took the time to.
But he's smarter than that too, though.
But exactly. But I mean, it's just like, you know, I did what I had to do, and she's dead. That's really what it comes down to. Yeah. And he kind of does. He's like, I shot her. No, that's right. Yeah, I stabbed her. You know, it's like, whatever.
I felt like he might be lying. I don't know. I guess I read it differently than you.
Yeah, I mean, I just see it. They're just kind of digging into his personal, you know, his personal grasp on reality, which is, he doesn't have one. He really doesn't. He's just so eluded to the fact of there is reality that he's so distant from it. He's just willing to go.
See,
yeah.
The reason,
whatever.
What I think is, he was like, I don't know. Like, I thought he might be planner or something to get her. 'Cause she told him a story about like her past thing. And he told the story about his bad parent with the mom being a whore and stuff, made him watch it. Mm-hmm. Stuff, making her feel sympathetic. I kind of got that she, I don't know, I maybe I'm wrong, because I thought he slipped up when he said, oh, that's right, I stabbed her, because he fucked up his story because he was playing her or whatever. But
yeah,
I guess you could be right.
I mean, like I said, it could go either way. I mean, I don't exactly know what the filmmakers had intent, but I've always thought that it was just, they're really just trying to get into the fact that he has no emotional attachment to what happened in his past, that he can't even fucking remember. Right. You know, generally, like me and you, if something bad happened, we would remember probably to a point, but he's just like, I mean, someone said I shot her, or did you stab her? Like, even the fact that someone mentioned another way of killing her, he's like, yeah, that's probably what happened.
Oh,
because
I understand so much, what you're saying. And
you know,
he's so disillusioned.
He's so disillusioned that the way I see that conversation coming off, I'm just like, yeah, he's just telling her. He's like, whatever. You want to hear this? That's what I'm going
to
tell you.
To me, I don't know if I like that, though, because to me, it almost makes the character feel less smart in a way.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Henry wasn't really, I mean, he was smart in his own ways. Like, he was smart.
I'm talking about this character, though, Michael Rooker, not like the real Henry.
You know? Well, no, I mean, even in there, because even in the film, I mean, he goes on to talk about, you know, specific ways of killing people. I mean, it's just even being inventive, like, you know, pulling the car over and flagging someone down just to shoot them.
He seems pretty smart in his, like, manipulation and sort of his, control over Otis, for example. And he's, you know, the whole thing, like, you never kill somebody with the same gun and things like that. And I'm like, okay, that's it's more of like a criminal, like compulsive, like serial killer thing, but it's not in like a dumb way.
No, it's funny because there is an interesting contrast there, because there's one scene in the film where, you know, after they do one of the most famous scenes from the film where they film killing that family on the videotape there. Well, they make this really odd mistake of Otis actually, he's got his head out the car and he breaks the camera and he fucking gets all pissed off and throws the camera out the window. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about that scene is that the tape is in there, you know, and it doesn't really dawn on either of them that, you know, throwing the camera out with the tape with evidence like that could be a bad thing. But Henry, at the same time, during that scene, has the frame of mind to not let Otis rape her because he's leaving evidence behind. You know, it's very strange at times. You know, I don't know if that's just the way, you know, seen it.
Did we know that the tape was in there, though?
Yeah, well, of course it was.
Why?
Of course it was. I don't know. I mean, I guess it couldn't have been. But I mean, if you know
the
story,
they could have put a different tape in.
Oh,
it wasn't in the same scene, right?
No, it definitely wasn't. But I mean, if you do,
I thought the tape was at the house in the VHS player.
Hmm. But there actually is a scene in real life where they'd filmed some killings and the tape got out somehow. And I'm assuming this is what they were alluding to. You know, the fact that they threw it away, you know, and this is actually
you talking about the real story that they found a tape?
Yeah, they actually filmed.
I don't really know it's been so long since I've looked up anything about Henry.
So that's why I was kind of alluding to the fact that, you know, they were just not really thinking twice about throwing the tape out there, because this is actually based on a real event, you know. I mean, obviously some of the things are fabricated there, but
yeah.
You know, that was based off of something that really happened, because this tape did eventually surface, you know, of these murders and stuff.
Yeah, I didn't see, when I was watching it, I didn't put that together. I just thought that the tape was still at the hotel or the house or whatever.
But I do think, though, the overall product of this film is really, it's a very menacing film. I mean, it's not very often you can watch a film that doesn't really have a structured narrative at all. This film is just about two characters that, you know, are
leading. But there is an arc.
Well, I mean, I guess. I mean,
there's a love story arc.
Yeah, I know. But
it's there. It's 100% there. It look, dude, the movie begins with the meeting. That's when the arc starts, and the movie ends with whatever happens with them, those characters. That's how it's a climax, so, and everything.
There's a very minimal story here, but you know, it's a very haunting film, because the thing I like about it's basically following these two characters that are living almost pointless lives. Like, they really don't have any purpose. You know, I mean, you could argue that Henry's purpose was just to kill, but I love how McNaughton showcases that so well. It's just every scene, they're just, okay, what do you want to do now? Kind of thing.
Yeah,
they're not
Becky
really trying to get
really have a purpose
to
either.
I know, and
and all three of them live in
together. It's a nice contrast.
Apartment where they do these regular things, like have dinner, and then it's like, I don't know, want to go get a beer. Like, that actually reminds me of when I used to live with a lot of people, and none of them had jobs, and it was just this like flowy thing where it's like, you know, that they would like, everything was like kind of, you know, basic. Everything was just like, what do you want to do, you know? And it, you know, it definitely reminded me of that. And yeah, I like that about it, because it makes them seem even less human, I guess, you know, because they're just kind of floating.
Well, that's the thing, man. You showcase these two guys living pointless lives with a pointless narrative to a point.
There's random scenes. Like, you have a random scene where the Otis sells drugs. And if anything, I guess it's to sort of, I guess, give you the hints that Otis is sort of a closet homosexual, maybe.
Yeah, I never was really fully sure on what they were trying to do with that scene right there. It is strange because, you know, like I said, you know, at the top of the show, that Otis even tries to rape his sister. And at one point he puts his hand on this high school kid's leg. And I'm like, it is strange. Otis's character is strange. And I think they're just kind of getting to the point like, this guy is just, he's just either fucked in the head or confused, or I don't really know what they're trying to do with that. to be honest.
He's just a weirdo.
He is, man. I think it's just, he just really doesn't have a purpose that he's willing to do anything. I mean, this is what happens to some people. It's like, you don't have that everyday purpose. So
no question.
I don't know.
Was Becky part of the actual story of Henry Lee Lucas? Like, did Otis have a sister that there was like a love interest there and they like lived together and shit?
As far as I know, I don't know about that. I have never read about Becky. She could have been there.
Because one of the slight issues that I have with the movie is from the very moment almost that Otis and Becky are together, Otis is coming on to Becky in an inappropriate way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that makes much sense, considering why would she go visit this dude? Because if he's doing it right away, then he obviously did it before when they were growing up. So why would she come live with this dude who's like,
I think it might just be something that you're just noticing. Maybe it wasn't even thought of, you know, who knows?
I don't really know. Plot hole?
Big time.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably something they didn't even realize, is kind of threw that in there. Oh, I mean, it's just kind of making Otis look like more of a scumbag than he is, you know?
Yeah. But that's the major plot hole then.
It is. Yeah, man, this one is just fuck, dude. Like, you know, for such a low budget film, isn't it incredible? Like how low budget this film is.
How low budget was it? Cause I don't know,
man. It looks low budget. It feels low budget.
$111,000.
So yeah. But it just has like it's got really good acting in this. Like Michael Rooker just kills this fucking role as Henry.
Yeah, he does really, really good job.
Every scene, man, he's menacing.
He actually does remind me of Henry Lee Lucas. Like he kind of has that look and stuff for sure.
Yeah, man, he's just super menacing. He's got that alpha male. He's a very strong individual, and he's fucking believable, man. But so is Otis, though, man. Like Tom Towles, like he plays
does a really good
Otis.
Job.
He does a great job as Otis, man. He's fantastic. I mean, if there was a weak link, it would be Becky, but she wasn't even that bad in this film. There's not really a whole lot of characters.
I can almost see why she is attracted to Henry in her way, because of the way that, you know, that she's kind of in trouble a little bit. He's like that alpha male dude. Like her life isn't going super good. They kind of bond over some things, and it kind of makes sense why she might be looking. And she had father
issues.
If
you look at it like that, of course, man, she had her issues, but I mean, obviously things were going so bad, and let's assume that she has had these encounters with Otis before and she knew what she was getting herself into. So she knows what she was doing, man. So it kind of makes sense that she would probably end up with something.
She was looking for a protector in a way.
Yeah. And she saw that in Henry, you know, even though that she probably.
Now, question, is Henry's motives genuine? Like, is he actually being protective over Becky because he, you know, cares? Because there's a few times, like one where Otis says that he's messing around when he tries to kiss Becky and Henry flips out and he's like, that's your sister. So is that genuine? Is there actual feelings there?
I think it is, because Henry, he talks about how, you know, I mean, basically the reason why he killed his mother is because she was a whore. You know, and I think he sees Becky as someone that could be possibly saved. Like, I mean, he admits many times that he's into girls. Like, you know, it's not like he hates women and he kills women just because or whatever. But I don't know, man. Maybe he sees something in that and he's trying to save her. I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, the only thing that, like, it's weird that they would choose that when they're trying to display the fact that he's a complete sociopath and doesn't care about anything. So, like, yeah. I find that the message and the story gets a little convoluted at times, or just confused. Well, same word.
It's actually one of my biggest complaints about the film, honestly, is the subplot with the kind of the love interest between Henry.
It's
and
essentially
Becky.
I mean, the only plot, which makes it even worse that it's so prevalent, you know?
Exactly. But, you know, it kind of set, I mean, if they threw that subplot into the film, the plot. I want to say subplot, but if they threw that in there for the sake of setting up the ending, then I mean, I guess I can kind of see that. But at the same time, I completely 100% agree with you that it's a little contrived, because this is a sociopath we're dealing with, right? You think that he would become that accustomed to saving her? I mean, he doesn't know Becky,
which is
he doesn't even fucking know Otis, man.
Which is why I so strongly wanted to believe that he was playing her. Because, like, then it would make the sociopath angle make sense. But if he actually cares about her, then it kind of doesn't make it make sense, which is like it's
hard to say. I mean, I think that they were trying to be genuine with him actually caring and trying to save her and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, try to put a little bit of I don't know, man. They don't do it as much in this film as they do in the second film, making Henry more of a sympathetic character. I mean, I guess there's moments in this one where he's saving her from, you know, Otis kissing and, you know, Otis raping her and things like that. Like he's playing the hero part. I don't know, man. I think honestly, it's a little bit of,
it's just, the same question I come back to is why? Why is he saving her from kissing her? Why is he saving her from raping her? Does he just have standards? Does he just be like, no, like we'll kill people's throats and stuff, but not this. You know, it's confusing to me.
It can go back to the whole point of, you know, he's a sociopath. I mean, we really don't fully understand sociopaths in general because, you know, there's been different cases of people that they just showcase different symptoms and they do different things, you know, being a sociopath. And maybe Henry's is, maybe he's just a little sympathetic to the one that's, you know, he just feels like she needs to be saved or something. I don't know. It's really strange. Who really knows what they're trying to allude to with that? But
yeah, I mean, I think there might be a commentary on the disc. I was, you know, if I had more time, I was going to listen to it because hopefully there was some insight in there. What'd you say?
Did you watch a Dark Sky Films?
Yes.
DVD release? Okay. So I have the older DVD release of it, which unfortunately was like in full screen. And it's funny too, the approximate runtime on the backs is 130 minutes.
Really?
I was like, what the fuck?
83 minutes.
Yeah, there is one. It says Recollections with director John McNaughton. And that's about it. But yeah, there is a commentary on there though.
My disc is over. Across the room. Okay. So
but that would
know.
Be it would be interesting to get some insight into what they were thinking because all we can do is speculate, right? I mean, we're dealing with a sociopath here, so it's already pure speculation.
Yeah, but at the same time, if we're reviewing it, we have to judge based on what we're presented. And I do think that it's slightly conflicting with what we're seeing and what we're seeing early in the film. I'm not sure what the idea is here.
Like I said, though, man, like he obviously has minor hatred. I mean, he kills women, he kills guys, whatever. But going back to the fact of the reason why he killed his mother, because she was a whore. And that's really what he says, you know, maybe he just for some odd reason feels some
if
type
he
of
really
towards
even
her
did
in those
though,
moments.
You know? Like
maybe he feels bad for her because he knows Otis is a piece of shit. But that's again, you know, that's kind of a little contriving.
But at
the
same time, also, when you factor in certain end things, you start to wonder even more, like, okay, so was this all like, is what is genuine and what is not? I really don't know. And that's the big thing that I took away from this film. The big negative is just that I feel like it is slightly messy with that whole narrative with the Becky thing. And if there is an answer, it would maybe change my opinion on it. But as a viewer, I see that it's either sloppy or I'm just missing it. Or it's honestly trying to do two different things, which is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I see it maybe that he's feeling some type of sympathy for her.
I almost don't like thinking that though, because then I feel like it betrays other things.
I know, and that's kind of the downfall. I mean, that is really what I do think, and I think that's a big mistake in the film.
I do, too.
Because we're dealing with someone that is totally should not be feeling like that,
and
right?
I understand in hindsight, that there's levels of people, right? Everything's not white and black. But in this
our setup is giving us something totally different, and then we get hints of something else.
Yeah.
That's there. It is a little bit, yeah, I mean – you know.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know, it's like you're so strong on one side and then you switch things up on me, but it doesn't feel, it's like, it's not the right way. There's a right way to make somebody have multiple emotions where they feel bad and they don't feel bad and they feel hatred and they're like sort of schizophrenic like that. There's a way to do that, but that's not what they were doing with Henry though. They were making him more of a sociopath. So that's why it doesn't fit to me to be like these up and down emotions. However though, pretty damn good movie.
Yeah, how about this?
Hey, how about those bears? fuck the bears.
There you go.
Okay.
I just love that because, like, you know, in 86, man, the Bears were fucking awesome.
And he's like, set fuck in the Chicago Bears. Which we haven't mentioned, and yeah. I love the set.
Oh no, I was getting there. We just kind of went on off on a very long tangent, but yeah, the grittiness of the Chicago in those days, right?
Yes,
pretty cool, man. Yeah, it looks good. Looks good.
All right, so what else you got, man?
I don't know, man. I really dig this film, man. I think that, you know, like I said, man, I like the fact that there's very minimal narrative here. And I think it's just in perfect contrast to our characters that are completely lost. Like, you don't need to have this major structured narrative because we're following two people that don't have anywhere to go. Right. So it mm-hmm. completely makes sense to me. I love the low budget feel to it, man. It just feels like it's very menacing. The performances are just outstanding in this, but I completely agree with you with, you know, what you want to call your arc and stuff. With Becky and shit, but yeah, man, this one, I really do like the fact that they didn't have to go the route of showing, you know, showing all the killings and stuff.
I think even noticed that they didn't really, though. You know what I mean? Like, it's not one of those movies where you're like, oh, like
they show the big ones. I mean, in the beginning of the film, they lose a little bit of that, you know, in the second half, of course, because of the famous filming the family murders and stuff. Where I love, which by the way, I love that scene because we see that for the first time while they're watching the videotape.
Yeah,
and I love that scene too because it pans back and you're like, oh shit, they're watching
the videotape. It says a lot. It does. But your character's right there.
The best thing about that part, though, is when Henry looks over to Otis and goes, what are you doing? And he goes, I want to watch it again, man.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, god damn. You guys are fucked in the head. Like, that's some real sick shit right there.
Yeah, there's a scene where they're all dancing on the videotape. I mean, the video camera is like an important sort of narrative device in the film because we get to see a lot about the characters, like the scene you just said where they're watching it again and stuff like that. But he just sort of flips out and wants to stop all of a sudden. And, I feel like that means something too, but I don't know what really.
Yeah. I mean, we're getting real into some deep psychology with that shit, man.
Yeah. But it's definitely, there's a reason for it. It wasn't just for no reason.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's all very interesting too. I mean, I don't really want to talk about the very end of the film. I wish we possibly could, but like, the fuck that scene, man. Jesus Christ, dude. I mean, it just kind of puts everything right back onto track, in my opinion. You know, I think it kind of falters at one point with this arc that we're talking about, and then it just kind of goes back right into it. And the way the film ends is just, it's just like, wow.
Yeah, I really like the ending.
Holy fuck, you're like, damn, man, that's really...
Those are my favorite kind of endings, by
the way. Very serious. Me too, man. It's very serious, and it's like, wow, I mean... They didn't pull any punches, you know, at all. They kind of started with horror and they ended it with real true horror.
It's a really good bookend.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, I mean, do you want to go into ratings?
Yeah, sure, man.
Okay. So I guess I'll go first. I usually go first as of late. Sure. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer from the year 1986. I think it's very strong. It's definitely a really good movie. It, you know, it's a voyeuristic few days with these two serial killers. By the way, I like that it is two serial killers. You don't really get that. It's kind of – Henry gets all the credit, but they both were pretty messed up people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an interesting – there's a lot there in simple scenes. You know, anytime you can tell a story with literal just no dialogue, just, you know, you see something and you see something else. It's always, I love that stuff. I eat that stuff up. And this one does have its few questionable moments, but could have answers. They could have answers. Anyway, I like films that pose questions either way. So that's, even though it's a negative, it's kind of a positive at the same time. It's a film that goes by quick. It really does. The setting's good. There's not many things that I don't like about it besides the few things that we got into. Michael Rooker's performance is fantastic. The Tom Towles performance, who plays Otis, is fantastic. The direction's good. Music. One thing which I'll save that for the sequel, because there's something in the sequel too that does it as well. But anyway, 8 out of 10.
Yeah, man, this one right here I find to be actually a scary film, because I mean, these people, McNaughton kind of portrays it in a way that, you know, these people walk among us, you know, especially in the scene where, you know, Henry and Otis, they just go out, you know, they just go out to find trouble, just go out to kill someone. And, you know, it's where they flag down the car and they shoot this poor guy. And it's like, fuck, dude, it's just so goddamn.
That was brutal, by the way.
I know. I just find that shit so scary, and it's captured very well. It's in a low budget. It looks low budget, you know, but it's like low budget gratification when you watch this. You're just like, yeah, man, you know,
this is cases that the low budget actually helps the look of the film.
It adds to it, man. It's that grimy, you know, they capture a lot of nighttime scenes in Chicago, really dirty areas and stuff, which is really cool. What sells this film the most for me is the acting. Michael Rooker, Tom Tallis, they do fantastic jobs. They're so damn believable, so fucking menacing. I like the fact that they didn't have to over-accentuate the kill scenes and stuff. There's one really cool, I mean, some of the dead bodies look fantastic, but there's this one dead hooker in a hotel room with a bottle like smashed down her throat, and it just looks fucking vile, man. It just looks nasty. Like, man, it just shows how vicious he was. It just really portrays the character so well, and the fact that he has no regard for life and he's a true sociopath, man. And I love it, man. Yeah, it isn't without faults. JP mentioned it. I think the thing with Becky is a little bit, I think it gets away from the real horror, and it starts to show something that, you know, it's a little confusing. But again, I have to agree. I do like movies that raise questions. It makes me think, and we're still thinking about it, and I'll probably be thinking about it after we're done talking about this too, because I have to find an answer now, because you're a fucking asshole for bringing that up. So but yeah, man, I've never had any major problems with this film. I think there is room for improvement, but with that said, it's just such a menacing watch. It goes by super fast. What is it, like 85 minutes long or something like that? It goes by really, really fast. Yeah. And, yeah, it's just got some really great scenes, man. Really, really great stuff. I give it 9 out of 10.
All right. Awesome. So we go into Henry 2, Portrait of a Serial Killer, from the year 1996, of course. Henry 2, Portrait of a Serial Killer. I don't know why it was called. It should have been called Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer 2, don't you think?
I know. I never understood this title. It always fucking confused me.
By the way, there's one DVD version of this that has a atrocious cover.
Really? There's another release this? I thought Dark Sky was the only
one. Yeah, there is another release. It is awful. Terrible cover. It's got fire all over it.
So the guy that directed this film, Chuck Porello, he actually directed Ed Gein, which is a really cool film from 2001, 2002?
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the Hillside Strangler yet.
That's another serial killer film.
Which there's the... Yeah. So he likes the serial killer films. But I don't even know if that was any good. But yeah. So... Henry 2, Portrait of a Serial Killer from 1996. Want to do the honors? This one actually kind of does have a structured narrative to it, I guess. In a way. It's kind of funny. This one is very similar to the first film, but at the same time, it's not. It's weird.
Yeah, so Henry 2 picks up where the original left off. Henry takes a thankless job at a port-a-john company where he meets a husband and a wife, Kai and Cricket. They take pity on the homeless drifter and offer him a room in the home they share with their emotionally fragile niece, Louise. That's kind of your basic plot. So
yeah.
First of all, first thing that I'm going to say is it is very jarring. Henry has gained a lot of weight.
dude, it is so, it's almost distracting when you, because I watch these back to back again, and I was like, wow, that is just not Michael Rooker, because he's shorter and he's fatter.
Yeah.
And so even his demeanor is different.
Yeah. So. And then you sort of, it's very jarring when he starts acting too, and it's not Michael Rooker. So once you kind of get used to that, then you can let the movie start going. There's a weird scene early on where he's at a homeless shelter and there's a weird dude who just decides to pull down another dude's pants and start humping
and dry hump him.
Yeah.
And he's dry humping. And I was like, what the fuck?
And the dude's like, get off me, please get off me. And I'm like, what the fuck?
I always thought that was interesting, too, how they started off the film. And you can tell that, like, Henry's super uncomfortable by it and stuff. But don't you get it? Don't you get the impression that, like, he's just he almost seems like he's a different type of character?
It's a completely different portrayal of Henry.
It is, man. He seems a little more local.
Michael Rooker and this guy obviously did not share notes before they – before he did the sequel.
You know, it's unfortunate too, because Michael Rooker was actually offered this job for Henry II, but he turned it down.
No.
And it would have been really cool to see him in this film, because I think this film probably would have been maybe a lot better. I don't know. But I don't know, man. You can just tell, like, right away in this film, you can tell that the filmmaker is trying to, I don't know, man. The portrayal of Henry, he's trying to make you feel sympathy for him a little bit. By having him in this, homeless shelter or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Henry that we knew from the first one, I don't think that he was going to a homeless shelter. I just thought that was a very interesting thing right away. I was like, what the fuck?
I mean, do you know how many years this film is supposed to take place after the original?
It doesn't give you a timeline. It doesn't even give you fucking dates or any, like, there's nothing on this. So it's supposed to take place, it says, right after the first one. So who knows, man? Maybe he drives a county over and it's just,
if you wanted to say that Henry was like much older in this film, then you might be able to get away with like the way he is.
The way I've gathered, it is supposed to be directly after. So I'm thinking, you know, maybe he stayed over and it's just, wow, it's so like you said, jarring.
Yeah.
It's very jarring.
You know, it's also weird in general to make a sequel to a film that is like sort of a biography, even though it's not a biography in a way it kind of is, because it's based on a real serial killer. So to make a sequel to that it's kind of a weird idea. Right. I mean,
yeah,
but yeah, so
it's a non-fictional character based in this kind of fictional reality or this fictional setting kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like I missed the part in the documentary where, Henry like joined teams with an arsonist.
I know, right?
I know.
So Henry II it's kind of a weird narrative, because it is so different from the first one, and you really have sort of this.
It's because of the first like 30 minutes. Henry is such different. You know, like I said, he's different because they're trying to make you feel sympathy for him. Like he's all kind of down on his luck. He needs a job and stuff. And just the way he's kind of moping around and the way he's talking and stuff, like he's just kind of, you can tell he's desperate, you know, and like you're supposed, but you know exactly who this guy is. And it's just a very strange portrayal of the character. And, but it kind of goes on and on. Like, you know, after Kai and his wife take him in, you know, he's very kind of like, almost shy and like kind of downbeat and stuff. He's just,
yeah, which
he's not
is
like
not
that guy.
Henry. Like, that's not the no. Henry we've seen. He was very, he would talk, he would say things. He
well,
would
that's
command
the thing.
Your attention a bit.
There's a scene where Buddy comes over, the guy that's, you know, hiring Kai to do the arson jobs. And I'm watching Henry's, or, you know, the performance and Neil Guntali's.
By the way, Neil, say it again.
Guntali or something like that. Yeah.
That's a good old Eddie Caputo from 1998's Child's Play.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But anyways, so, you know, they're going down in the basement and I'm watching, you know, his performance and he's sitting at the table and you can tell like his shoulders kind of drop down and you can see that he feels uncomfortable and stuff. It's like this Henry would be all in there, like leaning back on his chair and being like, yo man, what's up?
Yeah.
Like, what are you guys doing? You know, just kind of like not trying to get too involved, but just being like, because he's an alpha male, he needs to kind of be in control and stuff. But this portrayal is just so fucking strange. You
know what I think is most jarring is the voice. The voice is that Michael Rooker just has that voice. And it's so different. These movies are not a good idea to watch back to back, like in close proximity, because
I took 20 minutes between. I made myself a wrap.
Yeah, it's even way more jarring. But so there's a scene that I want to mention where Henry is seeing the niece, which I don't know what is your gauge on her age. By the way,
well, she's in night school. I'm assuming that she's in college and stuff. I think she's like in her early 20s, kind of thing.
Well, it says in the plot that she's a teenager. So,
It says in the, really
does
because
it, does it say she's in college specifically?
Yeah, because she. Yeah, because the auntie, the wife, she says that yeah, she's taking night classes, or whatever. And well, I mean that would
be 19 and
1920, yeah, something like that.
Because I was wondering like how old she was supposed to be, but anyway, judging by this scene where two little kids pick on her, like I figured she might be a little younger, which honestly would have made the story a lot better if she had been like 16 or something.
I know, right?
Another level of weirdness to it. But, yeah, so she's probably like 19 or something. These two little kids pick on her. Henry runs over and is like, hey, you stop that. And like knocks over this little kid who like, I think there was blood on his forehead, but I'm not sure. And yeah. I'm like, okay, physically assault two kids and nobody in the scene seems to find that odd at all. You know, the guy that you just let in your house to stay in the basement physically assaults two little kids. Like, I know that nowadays, like, you know, you can't even like blow air at a kid and not be like hauled off to prison, but even in 96 this is not likely to happen where you knock two little kids over as
and that scene itself kind of starts a subplot too, because there's like there's like this whole revenge thing. It kind of goes back and forth and you're just like, okay.
And you also think a guy who is, you know, probably killed a lot of people across the country being his drifter killer self, left a lot of bodies laying around. Like, you think that he might want to try to keep a low profile and not assault two kids.
I know, right?
That, once again, that also betrays like the smartness of the Henry before, who was talking about you don't want to kill people the same way and stuff. There was one funny moment, Modes.
What's that?
Well, there's probably more than one, but one thing that I actually, you know me, I don't really bust out laughing a lot when I'm watching movies. I'm very serious all the time, and I'm just like, if you can picture me watching a movie, it's me sitting back on a couch with my arms crossed, like entertained. That's the cartoony version of me. So two guys are the Henry and the, you know, guy that he's living with. They're working on the porta johns, and these guys walk past and they're like, that's a shitty job. And I'm like, clever, because their job is literally a shitty job. Oops.
I like that shit too, man. It was funny. I just like the look that he gives him too. He just gives him that fucking eye, like, fuck you, man.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting scene, because that kind of, it's almost like that joke kind of set the fire back into Henry, because later on after that, that's when they go and do their, I think they go and do their job. Was it their first job right after that? When they find the squatters in there?
Well, no, because what happens next is another scene that's really stupid. And that is that Henry knows that something's going on in the basement. So he's chilling at his, you know, where he's being allowed to stay at. And he
that happens before they go
into the homeowners, the person that gave him the job, the person that's letting him stay under his roof, sneaks into his bedroom while he's sleeping, steals the basement keys, goes down in the basement, finds all this gas cans and all this other shit, and Celerine. Then the guy walks in on him in there, and then he decides to tell him his diabolical plan about his insurance scams. And I'm thinking, like, okay, first of all, this guy who you don't know, you've seen assault two kids, steals your keys, goes down into your basement, sees your secret scams that your insurance scams, and then you invite him in on it? Are you kidding me? What are you talking about? You're committing arson, burning down houses for insurance money. This guy has assaulted two kids. You know nothing about him. He's a drifter. He steals your keys. While he's staying at your house that you let him stay at, sneaks down into your secret basement and finds your plans, and you're going to invite him in on it. That is one huge, giant mega pothole.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty fucking laughable. But that's kind of the point in the film where it changes Henry's demeanor right there.
Yeah.
You know, because they go out there and, you know, they set fire to this place and they come across these fucking squatters or whatever just before they're ready to do it. Anyways, they more or less kidnap the fucking guys.
Well, they looked young. I would say probably about 17, 18.
Yeah, 20. Yeah. So instead
of
actually
they were drug addicts, they were smoking crack.
Yeah, and they kind of they almost give an excuse in the film to kill him. He like,
which
and
again,
he pulls out, he finds this like fucking meth pipe or whatever, and he's like, "Oh, here they're meth heads. We have to execute them."
Yeah, thing, which, right? By the way, I was like, "Oh shit, just got real, man, brutal." Like, yeah. I like the way that they kind of set that scene up where they kind of kidnap them. You're not sure what they're really gonna do with them. Like, you figure they're just gonna burn them. Like, at first, I thought they were gonna tie him up and he was gonna burn them in the building.
Yeah, yeah.
But then. Which actually would have made more sense because it's like, oh, well, they probably were staying there and their crack pipe blew up and caught shit on fire and burned out.
It would have made all the more sense because right before that, Kai was telling Henry about his accelerant and how it burns at like 500,000 times hotter, faster, whatever.
Yeah, which is supposedly burns all the evidence that you use to light the fire.
Exactly. You know, you would have never left the bodies behind, but, you know, it is what it is. I guess you want to have some fun, but that's a turning point. And, you know, that kind of puts Henry back in charge a little bit, you know. And it kind of gives Kai like the, I don't know what you want to call it. It kind of gives him a little bit of initiative to go out and do some more, maybe a little bit. But he's kind of an odd character in the film because you're never really fully sure which way he wants to go.
Because
I know that's
the
thing. Because he's already a bad guy, but then he doesn't want to do this. And then of course they try to recreate, you know, that famous videotape scene from the first film in this one where he's like a total fail and he won't fucking kill the lady and stuff. And
that was after he's seen dude cut his head off. And like, it's like, okay, the stupid thing about that character is, so they find these squatters, they kidnap them instead of burning them up in the house, which would have been pretty brutal. But then they even do something more brutal where they tie them to a fence and shoot them.
Yeah.
And right then and there, it's like, okay, so you tie him to the fence. Henry wants you to kill one of them. Like, how do all of a sudden you go from like an arsonist, which honestly, let's be real, like that's bad.
Well, because they actually give hints. They actually give hints to Kai that, you know, that he potentially might turn this way anyways.
What
because
was the hints?
Well, because after the parents of the kids showed up at the house. And the wife spit in their face. He was fucking totally pissed off and stuff. He's like, oh, just let me go over there and fucking kill him or whatever and stuff like that. And he was like, he was all jacked up and worked up about it and shit.
Yeah,
so
but like,
I think that's kind of
things like, I'll fucking kill that guy, yo. Like,
no, I know. It's I'm not even defending this. It's just their reasoning behind it. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, he said this one time, but now, and this is kind of like a prelude to this. He was like, well, you know, this is my opportunity to follow through with what I say, kind of thing, right? So I think that's what their minor setup is.
That is their minor setup, but it doesn't work.
It totally doesn't because he's not a killer. He's a fucking arsonist.
Yeah, dude. Nobody just jumps into killing like that. Like, you know, you're not like.
No, I mean, the whole plot, the whole character, it just does not make sense. As a matter of fact, like the whole middle of this film, to be honest, you know, you think even though this film is like 100 times gorier than the first one, it actually shows a lot of the kills, which is, of course, not as effective as the first film. I mean, they try to recreate in the opening scenes, right, by panning out with a couple kills, but then they get into it right away.
Yeah.
And it's just not as effective, but this one is gory and stuff, but it doesn't work, man. The middle of the film, in my opinion, is fucking drags. It's actually kind of boring to me.
Well, see, I actually didn't find it boring the whole movie at all. It is pretty short. Like,
it's 85 minutes, and I feel like it feels like 2 hours to me, man. Really? I don't know. There's something about this movie. It just kind of drags and stuff, and it just kind of keeps replaying the same type of scenes. And then, of course, you got that stupid subplot where, you know, Buddy's trying to get revenge, and oh, my God.
Well, my thing is, like, okay, by this point in the film, like, I'm like, okay, this movie's stupid. But now there's, like, some gory shit and, like, some kills and, like, throat slits, and I'm like, okay, well, if it's going to be stupid,
that
man, at least.
Nasty.
Huh?
The old man throat slit was
yeah. But seriously, like I'm thinking, like, okay, if this movie's gonna be stupid, at least it's being entertaining with some fun kills and different things. And honestly, one thing that I will say that I liked about it is that there was a like decent vibe with like some of the locations they're at, where they're in the house, like in the buildings that they're burning down and stuff, and it's like dark and. And I don't know, like it has that like 90s vibe, but not the
screen. You know what it is?
Vibe.
You know what it feels? It has that 90s thriller music in it.
It
fucking
does.
Feels like 90s because of that music, man. It's crazy. I understand about some of the sets, yeah. Yeah. But there's so many stupid parts, man. Like the scene where Henry gets up to go to the bathroom. They're downstairs with that drug addict fucking guy and Kai's sitting there. And then, of course, Buddy pulls out some drugs and spikes Henry's drink there. Mm-hmm. And like Kai just, of course, Kai's like kind of on the fence. He's like, well, you shouldn't have done that and stuff. It's like, are you fucking kidding me with this shit, man? Ridiculous. But of course, that's just their setup so he can fucking kill him anyways. But you know how it is. But I just thought the part was like completely ridiculous though. Fuck.
One thing that I hate, and this is also in the first film as well. I don't like when it's a serious movie and people snap people's necks with their bare hands. Like, I've always hated that in movies. It's so unrealistic. I don't like it. It unless you're Jason fucking Voorhees or some supernatural slasher, don't be snapping people's necks with your bare hands. You look
silly. I think it's because he's got lots of experience, so you know he knows how to work his hands.
Yeah.
But well, anyway, what? Okay,
this is not a kung fu movie, guys.
Okay, now,
this is real life.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of issues with the Henry and Becky thing in the first film. Now this one goes a little bit further. This film really tries to portray Henry as a sympathetic character at times. It drives me fucking nuts, man.
I know. And you know what I think, dude?
They do it too much in this one.
This is my fucking giant thing. Why it all makes sense. Because the people who made this movie watched the first one and they were as confused as me and you on what the story was supposed to be. And they took it this way and they're like, oh, well, he's obviously this like guy who likes girls and stuff. Like, so
it's a good possibility, but they go a little bit too far with it though, I think, because I just can't imagine Henry, you know, sitting there like, okay, so this girl, I can't remember what her name is, but she's a niece and she's taking art night classes. So she's into art and she's very strange. She's very kind of out there. And so he sits down, he's having a conversation with her, and she believes that they're having a relationship kind of thing, right? Because she asks him to draw a picture, and he actually does. He draws this picture in which you're probably thinking it's going to be all nasty and shit, but he hands it to her, and it's like a fucking pony galloping through this green grass and nice blue sky. I'm like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
That just seems so unrealistic to me. Like, completely unrealistic. Well, I feel like it went too far with it.
Well, I think that there's a way that you could explain it, and it leads, but the problem is this film is so different from the first one. But again, with the Henry is smarter, but in this one he's not portrayed that way, so it doesn't work for this. But he was playing her. That's how it could work. That's how it could work, because she's kind of dumb, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it's I don't know, man. It's kind of offsetting, because if he's playing her, I mean, he keeps turning her down. He doesn't really want a whole lot to do with her. I mean, I don't know. It's such a weird subplot in the film that, like, you don't really know 100% where it's going to go.
I think in this film, like,
does he want her or does he not? Because he's taking the time.
Is what it is. In this
but film. Then he rejects her because, of course, he's like, well, I can't be doing that. It's a confliction of his mentality.
In this film, this is completely different from the first film. But see, in this film,
like, he can't do it because it's their niece. You know, having those type of moments. Like, what the fuck?
No. It's in this film, he's a sympathetic character. He's a character that wants that level of humanity, that level of connection, and he finds this girl. So he kind of does things on her level where he sees that this sympathetic pony thing will kind of connect them a bit. And in this film, he wants that. That's sort of the whole point of this one.
I don't think he 100% wants it, though. There's a part of him that wants it, because he, you know, he definitely wants it, bro.
100%.
He does, but then he fucking rejects her.
No. See, you're missing that point too. He, in this film, he's aware of who he is, and he cares so much that he wants to push her away because he's a monster. I think he might even say that in one scene where he says, I'm a bad man or something like that.
Oh no, he does.
Yeah. So in this he wants it real bad.
The picture, it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, she kind of wants a spark up relationship. Yeah, I get that completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, but like, to me, I just don't like it. I think it's just
I hate it.
It's too oversympathetic here. They kind of
It's a completely
they really kind of they dumb down the characters what they do in this film.
I'm
going
to tell everybody out there listening right now, the faster you completely forget about the first one, the more you can just move on, because this character is not the same person at all. 100%.
No.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't like it. Do not like that that they kind of changed the whole thing. There is one scene though that does connect this film directly to the first film with a line of continuity, which I always appreciate. It's a very nice gesture when you're making a sequel. Anybody out there making a sequel, please do that, because I go nuts with OCD shit.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yep. So there's a couple throat slits in this film. One with a decapitation at the end of it. It's weird seeing Henry as like an arsonist. Like he's just like, there's a huge chunk of this film that revolves around this arsonist thing.
I just feel like, yeah, I know. And I know it's almost too much of Kai's game, you know, instead of Henry, you know. I just feel like he's not even really that much in control in the film. And it's just a little offsetting, a little jarring, mm-hmm. Especially in the end too, because you can see where this film is going, you know, I mean,
and I don't like it.
Yeah, you can totally
it.
See where everything is, like how it's all going to go down, and you know, you kind of predict it in your mind, and then you go, wow, like everything I thought of happened. You know, I found this film to be just overly predictive, man. Like,
oh, 100%, predictable, dude.
It's so predictable in the end. It's like, oh my god, like, okay, you guys just wrote that in 5 minutes, we can tell. So I mean, this is, to me, it's a very forgettable film. It's very, very forgettable.
I wouldn't go as far as saying forgettable for me, because I'm going to be honest, like, I enjoyed this one.
You know, I bet you this movie had a fucking bigger budget. It feels lower. I mean, the quality of this film is interesting. It feels like a TV film at times. And what I mean by
that
is
that 96 vibe, though.
It's the transitions, because they will fade out and then fade in on these long fade outs and fade ins and stuff, like they were taking commercial break. It's very strange. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, this movie wasn't a TV film. It just has that vibe to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's like just stemming from the 90s. Sorry, I got the hiccups.
You know what's kind of interesting about Henry is that it first premiered in 1996 at Chicago International Film Festival and actually didn't get an official release in the U.S. till 98.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, because it probably didn't do very well at the film festival.
Yeah, oh, man, it's such a bizarre sequel. Honestly,
it,
I mean,
really is,
maybe,
man.
Michael Rooker read the script and was like, "Now pass."
Yeah, I don't want to play a sympathetic character. It's like, okay, I'm supposed to be this hardcore, menacing, just fucking don't give a fuck character. And this one, it's just not that.
Yeah,
it's not that at all, man. Yeah,
I'm kind of done on it too, bro.
I don't really have any more notes. I think we kind of covered everything that I even have written down here. I'm just trying to scan through here, but
want to go with the ratings?
I guess.
I'll go first.
So pretty much everything I have to say, I've already said. I think this one is just, it's a jarring mess. I really don't care for the sympathetic aspect of this film. I don't even like the portrayal of Henry. Is just, it's so off-putting. I don't really care for it. There's a lot of things happening in this that I have a hard time believing. I do appreciate, you know, with some of the gore and stuff. I think that was a nice thing. I mean, if you are going to have a messy narrative, you might as well, like you said, fill it in, fill up the gaps with some nice gore and stuff, which, you know, it was nice to see that it was at least practical, for Christ's sake. But this one to me is just messy, and it's my biggest complaint, though. I find it a little bit boring, and it's so predictable that I'm just like, woo. But even with all the negative said, there is things I do like about it. You know, but overall, I'm going to give it about an average mark. I'm going to give it 5 out of 10.
All right. So me personally, this one, as a sequel, it's not good, guys. It's an awful sequel, actually. But if this film was called, say, The Drifter, or, you know, The Tenet, or something stupid like that, or like The Arson.
Hey, The Tenet's a good film, man.
Yeah. But if this was like the, you know, The Drifter and The Arson, or something, or like or like the Port-a-John Killer or something like that. You watched it and you were like,
oh no, dude, the Drifter versus the Arsonist.
Yeah, there you go.
The worst title ever.
And if it honestly had no connection to Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, you'd be like, oh, that wasn't like a bad 90s little fucking serial killer thriller movie, you know, because the problem comes from us knowing the previous history of Henry. That's where the main problems, besides the stupid plot holes that I said, like how he steals the keys and shit and like that. But I mean, yeah. if this was just a random movie, and that's kind of how I watched it, and you guys might be saying like, well, JP, you're an asshole because you made that huge spill on Basket Case about how like it betrayed everything and that's why it sucked with Basket Case 2. And yeah, you're kind of right.
Contradicting yourself, man. But contradicting yourself.
This film, it is only one thing. It's Henry. And in Basket Case, there was so many elements that was the same yet different. Like, it's the same movie, and now it's just amped up in comedy. This one is just a character shift. And I think it's slightly different, but it is slightly contradictory as well. I just felt like it worked a little bit easier to disconnect them in this one than in Basket Case. And it's probably because it's same director, same style, same characters. This one is only one same character, and he's kind of different. Maybe he's different after what happened at the end of the first film kind of triggered something in him. That could be argued. It could be. It's problematic when you're dealing with Henry Lee Lucas as a person who was projected a certain way, and we know how he was, and he didn't change. So anyway, it's a movie that I honestly didn't mind. Like, I enjoyed the kills. It went pretty fast. I had a fun time talking about it while I was tweeting. It's not super good, not super bad, but I liked it more than I didn't like it, and I give it about a 6 out of 10.
Damn. Crazy. Crazy. Yeah, man. I feel like this one is just like an extension of the first film. But at the same time, I don't know. Maybe pointless is a hard adjective. But, you know, it's just not as good as the first one.
It's 100% pointless to do a sequel on Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer like this. But yeah. I honestly do think if this was just called Portrait of a Serial Killer, or not even that, well, yeah, it could be called that. And it was not attached to Henry. Like, it would be probably you could disconnect that the character shifted so much, because that is the biggest argument, is just that it's not Henry. It's completely different. But you do have to keep in mind that you are judging it as a sequel because it's fucking called Henry too. So you do have to take points.
And you don't really have much choice either, considering it's supposed to take place directly after the first film.
Yeah.
That was the intent of the filmmakers. So yeah. Yeah, just not as good as the first one, obviously. I went from a 9 to a 5.
I went from an 8 to a 6, not as big of a jump.
So you were lower on the first one than me and higher on the second one. Fucking strange.
Yeah. I feel like that happens a lot.
That is weird. That's weird.
I mean, last time, didn't that happen with I Know What You Did last summer? Because I was like, I was higher than you on the first
film
and lower than you on the last film.
I think, yeah, it was, yeah, you were higher than me by a point and a half on the first film. We were dead on the second one. And the third one, I think I was a point and a half higher. I give a 5.5 and you give a 4.
4.5. So
4.5 or something. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think if you added the shit up, I think you're actually higher than me as a total rating on I Know What You Did Last Summer. Probably. Which is strange.
Probably.
Which doesn't really surprise me.
No. My main thing with the first one was the, like, I don't know. It's a good movie. It really is a good movie, but there's not a whole lot there to sort of dissect in terms of story, except for that one thing. And it just so happens that one thing was kind of messy. And this film,
it's where it loses points.
Yeah. The second film is just, it's just messy all around, but I did think that it had its moments, there was some decent kills and stuff. Like, I love throat slits. I almost sort of like the arson angle, as stupid as it was. Like, it's like, okay, like, Henry got a job fucking insurance frauding, cool.
mm-hmm. Yeah, the wife. I think she was from, I remember her from the Drew Carey show back in the day. Yeah, she was definitely on that show. I don't know why I even brought that up. But yeah, we can slightly see her nipples in this movie, though.
Yeah, I was definitely noticing that. I was like, okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that's going to conclude episode 83. And you know what? Unfortunately, I don't know when we're going to be back.
No, we're just taking it week by week as of now, guys. But
I'm actually going to be out of town all next week. So maybe the week after. I mean, it all depends on JP. But and I wish we could actually let you know possibly what the next show is going to be.
We haven't discussed it yet.
But we haven't discussed it yet. So we're just taking this step by step. So, you know, like the TGIF show. Fuck, I'm going to stop with the TV shows right now. Jesus. Yeah, man, I had fun, man. Henry 1 and 2, definitely interesting to talk about, I guess, to a point. But
yeah, I definitely did my fair share of ranting this episode, guys. Ooh, boy, I was going hard.
Yeah, I mean, that's what's going to happen when you're going to talk about these fucking synapse situations and... how can we not rant about that shit? Yeah. It'd be so awesome if they heard that shit, man.
I know.
Told you guys we called that shit. Anyways, I am just blabbing on. That's going to do it for episode 83. JP, you want to take us out?
Yo, guys. We out of here for another week. Potentially 2, 3, 4, 5 months. I don't know. No, we'll be back sooner than that. But yeah, you can check us out. All the cool places, facebook.com/group/22shotspodcast. That's where it's at. Also, horrorphilia.com. Thank you, Jason Lloyd, for hosting the podcast, giving us iTunes for free. You can catch all of our episodes on iTunes, including the Mini Shots episodes, which are not on Moods' channel because of copyright issues. Also, 22 Shots Podcast on Twitter. I've been live tweeting as I watch movies from 1996, it's turning out to be quite fun. Follow me on there. We actually need to get you on the 22 Shots podcast Twitter as well, Moods, so you could do some live tweeting.
I guess I could probably do that.
Yeah, that would be fun. 22shotsofmoodsandhorror@gmail.com if you want to send us an email. Also, if you want to rate us on iTunes, that would be appreciated very much. I think we've gotten more since the last time we've read them off. I think we have, I don't know, 13, 14 now reviews, something like that, which is pretty cool, pretty cool.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Or 17 ratings. I think we have 17 ratings. Yeah, the voicemail line, 724-426-6665. Again, that's 724-426-6665. As always, we love you guys. We love feedback the most, so keep doing that. Also, YouTube, Mood616, Double Shot J. Got anything else to add, Moods?
Yeah.
That's a wrap.